have hearing assist devices stored at the end of the dais. And with that, if you would all please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Supervisor Ray. Okay, we're going to have that on the highlight reel. Madam Clerk, I think there is at least one change to the agenda.
Correct. Added item to closed session, 1, personnel. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to 18, consider public employee appointment for the position of Director of General Services. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice requirement.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. That brings us then to the consent agenda. I do have a couple requests to speak. We'll start with Dane Sensor, followed by Gary Kirkland. I'll give you guys the start of public comment.
Dane Sensor, Oceano. Not that I want you to feel sorry for me or that anybody really cares, but I lost my job this last week after working very, very hard for a year and a half. And my point to that is now you're talking about increasing your salaries for the Board of Supervisors. Can't say that you're not doing your job maybe or you earn it, but there's those of us out of here that don't even have jobs now. And you know, I worked for a year and a half. I never got one day of vacation because I wanted my job. I was very grateful for my job. But you guys seem to think that you need a big fat raise, okay? Well, that's great. But, see, we're a little different. I work for a company that has to earn its money. I have to earn its money. I couldn't even get paid unless I sold something. That's how stressful the job was and how you had to earn what you make. And the company has to earn the money. The difference is the government, the county, it has people, it has employees. But like a company, you don't earn the money. You take the money from us, taxes. I look at my paycheck every week. I tell you, I want to cry to look at it, the taxes. And that's who we're paying. All of us out here from our tax money is paying you, okay? Which is fine. However, the problem is when somebody doesn't earn the money, they don't appreciate how to spend the money. And time again over the years, we've seen the county in wasteful spending.
Mr. Kirkland, followed by Julie Tacker.
Thank you very much. I have a proposal to deal with what the previous gentleman just talked about in terms of earning the money. What I propose is that we make all taxes at all levels, especially at the county level, voluntary. That way, if you people want money, you have to come to us, and we have to choose whether we want to pay for your services or not. If we don't pay for them, we shouldn't get them. Every business in this county that I'm aware of that's not a government business has to persuade the people to buy their goods or their services. You people should be in the same business. You should have to persuade us, not threaten us with prison or confiscation of our property if we don't pay the bills. If you were a business like any other business, which you are a business, there's a golf course. You guys are in the golfing business, for God's sake. What are you doing in the golf business? If you were a business like any other business, you would persuade us that we need to pay for your services. If you want a salary increase, come and talk to each one of us. Tell us that we should increase the amount of money we give to the government and therefore to pay for your salaries. And then we would decide, as your employers, which we are, that whether we want to pay you more or not. You shouldn't get to decide how much money you make. We should decide that as your employers and as your customers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkland. Ms. Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker, and I, too, am speaking to item 1. I understand that this is just to set the hearing and that a real discussion may take place next week. What I'd like to see in your staff report is a broader explanation. And I think what I want to hear when we go to the hearing, I want to hear from you, each of you, do you need this money? Is it really that you deserve it that justifies it, or do you personally need another $500 a month? When the board before most of you, reduced the salary, why don't you just go back there? Take that back. And then any CPI in the future. CPI. Why do we have to make up that difference? Why do we have to have an almost 2.5% jump and then another 2.5%? Why aren't we just taking back the little bit you gave up before and then go from there? That's what a pain plan is. We live within our means. So your staff report hopefully will be a little different next week.
Ms. Owen and Mr. Legato, did you want to speak to consent, or is that in general public comment? Very good. You'll be up first. Thank you, sir. Ms. Owen.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. Merry Christmas to everybody. And it sort of looks like Christmas here at Slo County. Last week you gave out $1,000 bonuses to 2,400 employees, $2.4 million, basically not into their health care plan, which was what you said it was for, but basically into their bank account so they could have a wonderful Christmas, I guess. Many of your employees don't even use county insurance. They're not in your policy plan. So I think it's time to remember that this county and the people that live in it, we have a pain plan that we live every day. It's our pain plan. And it means that we all cut back. We can't solve any problems by having a separation, a higher echelon of the people that sit up above keep getting raises, the people down below keep losing their jobs and paying more for groceries with no raises. So please join our pain plan and consider taking half of that raise, if anything, which would bring you up. We appreciate that you did take a cut for the last, I think, 3 years. But, you know, you're making $6,830 a month right now. That's a lot of money compared to most of the rest of us. So I beg you to please do the right thing and take half the salary at the most. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, ask colleagues if they have items to pull. Mr. Hill.
None, sir.
Ms. Arnold.
May I respond to some of the public comment quickly? Item one, if I could.
Item one, yeah. Okay. Mr. Meacham.
None.
And Ms. Ray.
No.
Ms. Arnold?
Thank you. So we had a couple speakers that came this morning to discuss item one, and actually that is set for hearing, so I'll look forward to the – I appreciate the comments, and I'll look forward to the discussion next.
It's commendable that we have so many teams from the San Luis Obispo County that have participated in the CIF playoffs, and an unprecedented issue came about when South County and North County both took the titles in the CIF football. This is a big accomplishment, and it doesn't happen very often. And matter of fact, I think it's only happened four times in Paso Robles' history. But the parents and the supporters that travel with these teams, that go all over to support them, I can't say enough for them. I mean, I have to admire all of their support. The other thing I just wanted to say is if you take a look at Atascadero that went to the semifinals, Templeton that went to the semifinals, Paso Robles that won the finals, God help the rest of everybody else if they put all those schools together someday.
Ms. Ray?
And I just wanted to add that this speaks to the level of engagement of our communities, and it speaks to the level of engagement of our kids. And sports fosters all the same leadership qualities it takes to step into this world and lead. And I know that firsthand for myself. I know that for our students. And on top of that, I just wanted to doubly acknowledge Nipomo High School. Not only did they win their first CIF championship, they won their first three times over. First league championship, first football championship, and first CIF championship ever in the history of the school. So it's quite an honor to sit here with one of the Titans jackets on and go Napomo and go Paso.
You're here. Congratulations to the Bearcats and the Titans. Impressive accomplishment. With that, we'll open general public comment items not on the agenda and within the purview of the board. Mr. Legato, would you like to lead us off, followed by Eric Greening?
Hello. My name is Jeff Legato. You may recognize me as the mapping and graphics guy from the planning department, but you might not know that I moonlight on the side as the chair for Action for Healthy Communities. And I recently took over for Biz. Biz Steinberg recently retired. Action for Healthy Communities is a consortium of public, private, and nonprofit organizations. We collaborate to come up with ideas on how to raise public awareness of issues that are affecting the county. And hopefully we can improve decision-making for folks like yourselves and establish some community goals to help preserve our wonderful county. So as part of the Community Foundation, we've been collecting data since 1999 in a survey that we do every 2 or 3 years, and it's a statistically valid telephone survey of all county residents. And I want to thank your board for your continuing support of this survey. We couldn't do it without your help. So my task here today is to introduce the homelessness folio. We produce these folios. There's going to be a couple more. And the homeless folio is a third related to our 2013 report. And some quick little tidbits of information. 3,500 homeless people in the county. Job loss was 28% reported. That was the main reason why people became homeless. Only 9% reported drug and alcohol use related to being homeless. 49% reported mental illness, and 71% were living in Still County before becoming homeless, so it's kind of a local issue here. 1,866 children were reported living doubled up with other households, which is the single most common living situation just before becoming homeless. So what's being done? The Board of Supervisors recently approved the 50 Now program with Transitions Mental Health, and we're continuing to implement the county's 10-year plan to end homelessness through the planning department. We should work towards increasing economic security for those at risk by providing things like child care and job training, and improving access to health care. So I believe you may have seen this report, but I'm going to leave some here for you, and I would like to invite people to visit our website, which is actionslow.org, where you can download the full report and these folios that we've produced. And thank you again for your continuing support.
Thank you, Mr. Legato, and thanks to everyone involved in Action for Healthy Communities. They provide us some really important information and more than a glimpse, a real vision into what's going on in our community and how we might be able to help. Appreciate your time. Mr. Greening, followed by Dane Sensor.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I would encourage the two supervisors wearing those colorful jackets to keep them on this afternoon. It will help give Julian Crocker a send-off on a real high note, and his support for all of these activities, whether it's athletics, whether it's the arts, and of course the arts are part of the football picture because there are always bands whose music is an integral part of the experience of the game. Anyway, the main thing I wanted to talk about is water and the Paso Robles Basin. And I am going to talk about some things that are happening in other jurisdictions, but it is coming to the probably most cost-effective way of having everybody come together and work on one plan. Then there still has to be an overall coordination effort so that you don't have rogue plans saying completely different things, because that would not meet the constraints of the law. That would invite the state in to manage the basin. So I'm asking you, before these separate efforts get too far off the ground, to convene a summit of, and this even crosses the county line into Monterey County, to convene a summit of all the players who might be interested in either participating in or preparing separate groundwater sustainability plans to define who will be responsible for the coordination effort? What will be the process? Because I think if we start to have separate efforts going off on their own tracks, it could be a much more expensive and difficult challenge later rather than if everyone is gathered around the same table at the beginning. And this county is the appropriate agency to convene everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Sensor, followed by Ben DeFada.
Dane Sensor, Oceano. I guess this comment pertains to last week when I read in the papers about the $1,000, I don't know what you'd call it, a gift for health care. As a lot of people spoke, and I read in the paper, $2.3 million given to the employees. The says here, the largest labor-driven economy government, largest employer. I don't get any health care anymore. Worst time, I guess, to get laid off, Christmas time. That's the time you want to get laid off. And, of course, I can't really complain. I feel blessed in a lot of ways because, you know, just to make a point here, there's a movie opening next door called Unbroken about the true story of Louis Campanini. After hearing his story and reading the book and listening to him on the radio last week, what that man went through, I think I'll never be, let's say I'll never complain as much as what he did for this country and what he went through. However, for this county to take $1,000, a lot of the employees have two families, so that's like $2,000 for a family for Christmas time, because you can really do whatever you want with it. There's no restriction on it. Goes straight to your health care against the health care insurance payment or whatever they pay for it. Just to get two bags of grocery these days costs $100. Two bags, and that doesn't even fill them. And I watch people walking, and who really don't have a home, and I see them walking from Oceano into the forest there and sleeping, and I'm thinking, there's $2.3 million in all these situations that $2.3 million, which I think could have been really put towards something that everybody can benefit from, everybody, because we're paying from our salaries. The government doesn't earn the money. It takes the tax people's money that earn the money from them and pays themselves. So there's no real earning of income. It's just a taking of income. I hope people realize that. The government is not a business, not a corporation. But if it did do what the corporations did, the corporations would be in prison, I think, a lot of them, for how they spend the money and foolishly. So, when Ponga boats are showing up on the shore here, I lost count of those situations like that. Maybe we can all go see the movie Unbroken so we can sort of compare and, not do a story about the county called Unbelievable for what they're doing. I hope you'll think about the people out there when you get this $1,000, how people like myself and many others, and I don't have it as bad as people in the street, I'll tell you.
Thank you, Mr. Sensor. Mr. DeFada, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, Public. Ben DeFada here. And tagging along with the previous speakers about you guys making too much money, not you five, but your management makes an awful lot of money and way out of. Okay, so if you think you own your home, something, try not paying your taxes and see how long you can stay in your home. Good morning. Just within the last month in the nation's political arena, we have seen big changes happening that are in the wind, like when just a few days ago, Louisiana's Democratic Senator Mary Landers lost her bid to keep her Senate seat after three terms as senator, making nine Democratic senators that bit the dust against Republican candidates in the Senate. When will you all learn to cut down on spending? Locally, for how many years have we, the people, told you that this board's chairman controlled the process to do it? Now, in the Oceano Sewer District, currently, the records show that the district is now running at less than 50% of its budget, and after several months, the plant is now even running cleaner. All of this at 50% of the cost. Anyway, just in the last month with the new political changes in Arroyo Grande, he will be the third of the good old boys club members to go down kicking and screaming, and who knows who else next year with the new mayor. Power to the people. Thank you.
Ms. Tacker, followed by Jeanette Watson.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker. And a couple of weeks ago, your board approved a feel-good project with the Bob Jones Bike Trailhead Project. Everybody feels good about that. It's a good thing to do. What I didn't like was Supervisor Hill's explanation of why county taxpayers needed to support this project. There's lots of reasons to support it, but this one, and I'll paraphrase, is that the new development in the city of San Luis Obispo will be at the south end of town. Why do county taxpayers need to support an improvement that benefits the city's residents? I don't understand that. Also, by making that statement, you're implying that it's a foregone conclusion that the airport safety zone will be reduced and that large developments proposed for the south end of the city will be built. That's not your job. Let the process play out and let's see what happens with that airport safety zone. Back to Los Osos. Again, we still haven't had an update. I don't see one on the agenda again today. We have many outstanding issues related to the project, but beyond the project, our groundwater management plan is set to hit the streets any day now. We heard last week from the Los Osos Community Services District Legal Counsel that it may be as soon as today. What I wonder is if you've read it. I wonder if you understand that there's a facilities district component that would tap the private well owners and the agriculture in our basin. Is that something that you all agree is the best way to go? Another layer of government going after ag? Let's have the conversation. We still haven't seen a habitat conservation plan. We haven't seen our LCP amendment or community plan. There's a second 218 yet to come for the vacant lots inside the prohibition zone. Where is all of this, Supervisor Gibson?
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ms. Watson, followed by Laura Mordaunt.
Hi, my name is Jeanette Watson of Arroyo Grande. Recently, the SLO County Board of Supervisors approved a $1,000 payment to every employee within the county. I ask you to use your wisdom and to be the watchdogs who will jealously guard the private citizen interests of our county. Also, there are plans to give the board a 5% raise, which will raise their salary approximately $86,000 a year to probably about $112,000. This will raise the pension liabilities, which the public in the county will have to pay and raise revenue. Why can't this just be a one-time gift to the board members, as it is with the $1,000 gift? Otherwise, it can take up to 30 years to pay these unfunded liabilities. When you give out them in raises, increases that go over many, many years show up in the actuary tables as funded liabilities. Will riding road vehicles in the dunes be slashed and cut back by ignoring the dunes' economic benefit to South County? Will the rail spur in Napomo, Phillips 66, be approved or stonewalled so that employer and economic benefit to the county be retained? Will the board use its land use regulatory program in the reform scheme of land use and allow the market to decide what kind of housing people really want, a single home with a garage and a yard?
It's a pretty interesting challenge to probably sit there and feel berated. I think that we are frustrated as citizens about how the balance of power, what it means if every employee were a public employee in the entire county. That was the only way you earned a living. That should ring bells, because it wouldn't happen. We would then be a totalitarian state. We would all work for nothing. And there we are. So I think this is serious because of the balance that has to be there. Government needs to be small. Government cannot sustain itself unless it takes from those who work elsewhere. So the question is the thinking, the advice you're given, provided in a manner that it colors how you really think? Have you lost the thought of what it means to be a public servant? And all of us know that you work for us, not me personally, but us citizens. And that, I think, is what is lost. Questions like, well, gee, what are other jurisdictions being paid with a similar population? That information was never provided. It doesn't get provided. There are so many unanswered questions. The questions aren't even asked. You're here to ask questions on our behalf so that we sunshine the information. So one of the things that I was recently reading, a monthly newsletter from CoLab, I thought this was very good. I don't know that I have time, but I will begin. The underlying issue, what is the proper functional role of county supervisors? What should be their civic ethos? Are they independent citizen, part-time, volunteer, policy-setting local legislators and watchdogs who jealously guard the private citizens' interest? Or are they full-time, salaried, politicized, micromanaging insiders? Which way are you falling? That is the question. One cannot effectively be both. Once they opt for the full-time salaried version, they become an interested party in the whole scheme of progressive compensation and consequent need for more revenue. More revenue. In turn, their independence and objectivity with respect erodes.
Thank you, Ms. Mordaunt. Ms. Owen, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning again, Lindy Owen. Recently we saw headlines that kind of shocked me way awake. This is the worst drought these past 3 years, the worst drought in 1,200 years. I don't know if that jiggled anybody else's brains. But this is not a temporary issue, and this is not a we don't have any solutions. If we don't get over this drought in another year, we're going to be opening taps with nothing in it. And I keep experiencing the fact that people are living in some la-la land, that their tap continues delivering water, their bill is bigger, but, oh, well, that's life. I spoke to a very wealthy household property that had beautiful green lawns front and back everywhere. Water runs off in the street every day. And mentioned that it might be time for them to consider drought-tolerant removal of their lawns and going drought-tolerant. And I was told that was of no interest to them. They're on a well. So there you go. If you're on a well, you're not part of the problem. So until this county wakes up and realizes that we need to have monitors on wells for the very reason that we pull those well owners into the solution and the reduction of the use, as much as anybody can. I'm not trying to say don't grow crops, but don't waste water. And people that don't have any idea how much comes out of their well or how much it influences the rest of our basins are living in la-la land. I would invite you to bring them into our land. Or, you know, next year may be the last year that we open our faucets and really all feel safe getting water. And then my other issue is rain. I've spoken many times before you to say that the contractors that put the pipes, the 42 miles of sewer pipes into Los Osos, part of their contract before they left was to clean up all the shoulders and right-of-ways.
Richard Margetson. This Saturday, the Los Osos Community Center, from 10 to 7, 10 in the morning to 7 at night, right after the Los Osos Chamber of Commerce Parade, is the 9th annual Needs and Wishes Holiday Fundraiser. This year's recipients from the event, Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter, the Transitional Food and Shelter out of South County, and the SLO NOR Clinic. The event was founded by myself and Jerry Walsh 9 years ago under the premise that everything at the event be donated by somebody and that every penny from the event go to the charities. We have no overhead for this event. And at some point this year, we will have gone over $300,000 raised. I was going to go a different direction this morning talking about the event, but I'm pretty much repeating what I said in the past. But when the two supervisors talked about the support of our children, it made me think about the participants this year in the event. And I just want to give you a list of why we should be supporting our children in these teaching experiences. First of all, we in the entertainment section, we have the Morro Bay High School Chamber Choir performing, the Los Osos Middle School Choir performing, both under the direction of Colleen Wall. We have three autistic gentlemen who will be performing. We have a group called Mini Melodies, a preschool music group that should be very cute. The Cuesta College is there's a jazz group that's coming from Cuesta College to perform. They'll be the last one on the program today or Saturday. Besides them, we have in the entertainment section we have Coast Union High School Interact Rotary Interact Club annually collects coins in their community through the holiday season. They come and present it on stage. This will be the fifth year. In the first 4 years, they've raised about $14,000. Collecting coins in the community. We also have the local 4-H at the event all day serving coffee, free coffee, cookies, and they go through the parade earlier in the day with little cans and collect change that they come and deposit in the 5-gallon jugs at the event. It's a great event. We have the usual silent auction, toy store, bake sale, raffle. The big prizes on the raffle this year are an Xbox One, a Keurig coffee maker, a robot dog this year, and a homemade gingerbread house, besides other things. Come, it's a great event. Entertainment all day. This Saturday, 10 in the morning till 7 at night. I put on the overhead if you want to make a donation and can't come, how to send a donation in, and the phone number if you have questions, 528-5800.
And Mr. Margetson, we do appreciate the support this event provides some very worthy causes. Could you also give the location?
South Bay Community Center in Los Osos, right behind the skateboard park on Los Osos Valley Road. 2180 Palisades Avenue is the address, but it's right behind the skateboard park.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, members of the board. My name is George Sullivan. I guess you could say of the greater Santa Margarita area. I'm here today to appeal to your board to try to get this back on radio. What happens here is very important, and I believe the public's best served by having radio as the venue. The internet, you know, most people work, and Buying a data plan or live streaming off Wi-Fi is just not practical, whereas a radio, we can still conduct other business and hear what's going on. And I just think it's very, very important that we don't rely on a public radio station who conceivably could use a form of clip art known as a microphone switch to steer the conversation. And I'm very unhappy that that's going on. And we have controversial subjects that are going to come before our commissions, before your board. And to have a host dictate how things should be discussed, I think it's unfortunate. I think the public needs to hear the whole story and get the real facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. That was our last request to speak in public comments. So I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to pick up on Mr. Margeson's comment about the kids. For the last 18 years, I've rang the bell for Salvation Army. And I can tell you the increasing number of kids that put money into those pots is amazing. And the little ones just shine when they come up there, just put pennies in there, whatever the case may be. So I have a lot of faith in the youth, thinking that they're going to be coming forward to...
Typically why they were on KCBX, or we were on KCBX, these meetings, even though there were some areas that were spotty, they had the broadest coverage. The other radio stations don't have the same type of coverage, and there are limited opportunities, and I can tell you even more limited interest from the radio stations to carry this for good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not opining whether that is a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just telling you the history of what's occurred. So certainly if anybody is listening to this via the Internet or watching it via TV, you know, feel free to contact the radio stations to let them know your interest, and if... you know, it's something we can pursue again down the road if there is interest.
Thank you.
It is frustrating, and we'll continue to hope that we might get that kind of broadcast back. So with that, we will go to our item for the morning. Madam Clerk, would you introduce it for us, please?
Item number 17, a hearing to consider a resolution for approval of an addendum to the final environmental impact report for revisions to conditions of approval 92, 27.RRRR, and 28.RRRR for the Santa Margarita Ranch Agricultural Residential Cluster Subdivision in order to comply with the preemptory right mandate issued by the San Luis Obispo County Superior Court in North County Watch et al. Versus County of San Luis Obispo et al. Case number CV-098-031-5.
Good morning, Ms. Carroll.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ellen Carroll from the Planning Department. This item is before your board today as a result of a lawsuit that was filed regarding the Santa Margarita Ranch project. Rob Fitzroy is our project manager, and he will be making our presentation today. Rob?
Mr. Fitzroy.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, fellow supervisors. As Ms. Carroll mentioned, the item before you today is in regards to the judgment issued by the Superior Court in regards to the Santa Margarita Ranch project. So starting with a little bit of background on the project, the Santa Margarita Ranch project was approved and the final EIR was certified on December 23, 2008 by the Board of Supervisors. The project included 111 clustered homes and one ranch headquarters on over 3,000 acres. Here's a layout of the project site. You can see the town of Santa Margarita to the north, and the ag cluster is there just to the south of the town of Santa Margarita. So following approval of the project, North County Watch and the Endangered Habitat League filed suit challenging approval and certification of the EIR. And on June 18, 2013, the Superior Court entered judgment and issued a writ of mandate. And that in part determined that the off-site air quality mitigation fee imposed on the project was inadequate. Specifically, the writ of mandate required the county to develop a record based upon substantial evidence supporting the establishment of an off-site air quality impact fee to mitigate the project's significant air quality impacts in compliance with CEQA. It also required that the county recirculate the off-site air quality impact fee and that the analysis of the fee and hold any hearings as required by law. So in response to the writ of mandate, the county prepared an addendum to the final EIR, and that was prepared in November of 2014. And the addendum was circulated for a 30-day public review period beginning in July and ending in early September. And we did receive four comment letters and responded to those accordingly. So the addendum analyzed and documented the establishment of the offsite fee. Emissions of the project were calculated using the most up-to-date model and methodologies, and the mitigation fee was based on the Carl Moyer program, which is a program endorsed by APCD, and that program establishes a fee of $17,720 per ton of emissions in excess of the threshold. So based upon the project's exceedances of the thresholds, the calculated fee was about $162,000 if the project was operational by the year 2016. And the money for these fees would be used to fund programs to reduce emissions within the air basin. So to comply with the writ, the county would need to revise certain conditions of approval of the original project, and those. So we have worked closely with APCD in preparation of the addendum, and we've also worked very closely with county council to ensure that what we're doing will satisfy the requirements of the judgment. Did want to make note of some additional correspondence. So subsequent to close of the comment period on the addendum, we received a few letters. So we received one from North County Watch. This was their second letter. We received that on December 4th. And that was regarding some issues they had with the conclusions of the addendum, as well as the what's called the 5.5 equity ratio. So we'll get into that a little bit later, but just wanted to make note of that. And the applicants provided two letters really in response to North County Watch's letter. And that was provided by their attorney, Bill Walters, as well as their air quality consultant. And I also did want to make note that the applicant, as of this morning, has submitted some revised language to Exhibit A, and we've submitted that to council, and we can jump into that a little bit later as well. So with that said, it's recommended that the board hold a public hearing to consider the addendum and the revised conditions of approval, and assign the resolution to revise the conditions of approval for the project in order to comply with the writ of mandate. With that said, I did want to make note that staff members of APCD are here to help us field questions as we need, as well as the consultant, Rincon consultants, that prepared the addendum. So that concludes staff's presentation, and turn it over to you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Fitzroy. Questions from the board? Let me go to the supervisor of the district first. Ms. Arnold, do you
have
anything?
No, I don't have any questions.
Mr. Hill.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is for Aaron and APCD. The correspondence that we received both from North County Watch and their attorneys makes a very strong point that the offset does not truly cover the actual impact on the air quality. And I want to know if you agree with these conclusions, and if not, why not? And if so, why are we doing this in the manner that is recommended?
If I may jump in,
sure.
Supervisor Hill. I did prepare a slide, and before maybe we go down that route, I would like to just kind of explain what the equity ratio is and what it does, and then maybe we can jump into some of the details after that. If we could get the PowerPoint up. The SLO APCD Air Quality Handbook has been revised as of 2012, I believe. And in their revised handbook, they have now what is called the 5.5 equity ratio. And The section here that you see is it states that project emissions above the pounds per day threshold must be converted to tons per year and then divided to the annual equity ratio value of 5.5. So I'm going to try and explain that to the best I can, and then if I'm struggling, I'll turn it over to Aaron. So what that really means is this is the equity ratio is a method to apply the annual threshold of 25 tons a year on a daily basis. Some projects exceed the daily threshold, which is 25 pounds per day, but sometimes they don't, and they don't exceed the annual. So here you can see on the slide the annual threshold is 25 tons a year, and the daily threshold is 25 pounds per day. So if we tried to annualize the current daily threshold and multiplied that by 365 days in a year, that's 4.5 tons per year. So if a project only exceeds daily, they're actually much more, it's actually a much more stringent threshold. So what the equity ratio really is trying to do is equate it to the annual threshold of 25 tons. So in essence, the 4.5 tons per year is really 5.5 times more stringent than the annual threshold. So to make it fair for projects that are only in the exceed the daily threshold, we would divide it by 5.5.
Well, what's the rationale for choosing the less stringent threshold? If I mean, we have now a I think from the governor on down a situation where all projects need to account for and mitigate air pollution of all kinds, whether it's greenhouse gas or not. So why would we choose the less stringent rather than the more stringent?
The larger 25 tons per year. And we were able to develop an analysis that showed the comparison, the more stringent threshold that's equivalent to 4.5 tons per year, and where they meet the 5.5 times equity ratio. It enables additional mitigation measures to be secured using offsite mitigation, but not unfairly disadvantaging those smaller projects.
Can I ask you how you determine which is a smaller project and how this applies to this project?
Smaller projects, I'm referring to those that exceed the 25 pounds per day threshold versus the 25 tons per year, the more stringent threshold. Those are smaller as far as fewer emissions. I'm thinking on emission size predominantly, air quality.
If I might, Mr. Hill, I think that there are a couple of questions in terms of rationale, and I'll just be honest, I haven't heard the rationale yet. But how does APCD judge what's fair and not fair in terms of mitigations imposed on a project?
We recommend for projects that exceed the pounds per day threshold and they can't mitigate on site to get below that, that the lead agency consider the use of off-site mitigation. And as our handbook structured, that's where we have the normalizer rate, the 5.5 equity ratio for the smaller scale projects. We look at all projects across the board based on their total emissions that are calculated, and we've been able to refine that over the years. As you've seen here in the addendum, where you're able to calculate the cleaner fleet as you progress out into the 50 years that this project would be in existence, as well as the use of wood stoves during a limited time of year.
We'll get back into the weeds. I'll turn the floor back to Mr. Hill with my thanks for the indulgence, sir.
Yeah, I'm still of the same mind, though, that I'm not really sure how, as you explained, there's discretion here to make the call, and I'm not really sure why that call was made in this case to go on the lower one.
The stringent threshold. Mm-hmm. We're recommending action based on the 25 pounds per day. But as our handbook outlines, and that's where our recommendations are coming from, we recommend the inclusion of this equity ratio to bring the smaller scale projects and the large projects in the same ballpark as far as the amount of mitigation that's needed. Otherwise, smaller projects such as this that only exceed the daily threshold would be fiscally penalized For being smaller, they'd have to pay a much higher rate than the larger projects that exceed the 25 tons per year. So to be fiscally equitable and still reducing the emissions, that's where we recommended our 5.5 equity ratio.
And you're confident in your calculations on that?
Yes.
Okay.
So I think I would like to just add to that that it is, looking at it from a larger perspective, the 25 tons per year is really that key threshold. So the APCD has estimated, you know, how many tons per year can be emitted in our air basin, and the project is still with, as noted, it only exceeds those daily, but in converting it, we're still applying that 25 tons per year threshold to ensure that significant air quality impacts aren't occurring in the basin.
With Mr. Hills concluded, I have to say that I don't agree completely with that conclusion. In fact, I don't agree that this project is being mitigated against either the stringent or the less stringent, the stringent being 25 pounds a day, the less stringent being 25 tons a year. I don't see that we're mitigating against either one of those. The calculation, and we'll get back to it, I'm sure, after we take comment from the public, is in Table 1 of Attachment 2, where, to my eye, a fudge factor has been applied. And I say that with all fondness. It is a term of art from my previous technical career. I think we're talking about some concepts of what constitutes a small project, and I think we can have a discussion as to whether this is a small project or not. We're talking about concepts of fairness, and we can have a discussion of what's fair or not. But basically, by application of the fudge factor here, we've instead of finding that the project exceeds a defined threshold by 2.64 tons per year, we've concluded that it only exceeds some undefined threshold by 0.48 tons per year. And again, I just simply, and I say this at face value, have not heard a reasonable explanation of why that is. Let me ask one question of counsel before I open it to the public, unless colleagues have, some other colleagues have questions.
12, and that, I would presume, since I wasn't here, was a board-adopted handbook. That's correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so would the applicant, based on what's in that handbook, would the applicant have been able to draw the same conclusion if they applied the same methodology? In other words, would they have been able to look at the handbook, apply the same methodology that APCD applied, and arrive at the same number?
Yes, they would for year 2016. We did further analysis working with RINCON and county on the increase or the cleanup of the fleet over the years of this project life. So the applicant, through an air quality consultant, could have replicated the calculations that are included here in the addendum based on the guidance that's in our handbook. It was approved in 2009 and as well as 2012.
So if I understand, the piece of the puzzle here that I'm missing is the cleanup of the fleet portion that you're talking about. So if you were to use no cleanup, which is essentially, as I'm hearing it, a sort of a reduction over time based on air quality standards or benchmarks that the auto industry will make, then that's where – how do you determine that part of the fee?
The out in time?
Yes.
Yeah, the California Air Resources Board has regulations imposed on both the fleet, the vehicle, the tailpipe standards, as well as the fuel standards. And those, both of those requirements are captured in air quality models. MFACT is for on-road. It's an on-road emission tool that captures the cleanup of the fleet out into time. So using those models in conjunction with another great acronym, CALIMOD, it's the land use handbook model that we use for quantifying air quality impacts from CEQA, you're able to calculate the reductions in emissions that are realized over time as our fleet cleans up.
And are those relatively scientific numbers, or are they theoretical numbers?
They're based on standards that have been adopted and in place and implemented forward. The only risk I guess you would have is if the state dropped all of the standards that are in place with vehicles. And, you know, manufacturers of those vehicles are planning now to reach the standards that are in place today as well as out in the future.
Okay, thank you. And then have we applied this formula yet to any other project?
Yes, we have used the equity ratio with other projects. I don't have an example of projects in mind on the top of my head, unfortunately, but this equity ratio, as I mentioned, has been in our handbook and recommended for guidance to lead agencies countywide with cities as well since 2009.
Okay, thank you very much.
Excuse me, Ms. Arnold.
Erin, I just want to ask a question. Really, overall, all the mitigation numbers are theoretical. In other words, we understand that this project contains 100 in total, 12 homes, and then we are theorizing as to how many trips people make each day and what kind of vehicles they drive, et cetera, right? It's kind of a best guess at that point.
Yeah, there's a number of studies that are in place. Mm-hmm. The transportation manuals that have done studies on different types of land use is where we get our vehicle trip numbers. And that's what we use, and that's what's incorporated into
sure.
CaliMod.
And that would be the best we have to go on. But my point I think I'm trying to make is that we are estimating who's going to move there, how much they're going to come and go, and usually and typically in planning to do the best job, we usually theorize at the top levels. In other words, since we don't know who's going to move there, we have to assume it could be a family of five, all the kids are active, and there's enough. So you're kind of taking average and maybe above average daily trips to just ensure that we're getting good data and we're not going to find ourselves on the other side of the line with what we're trying to mitigate for.
A reasonable worst case.
Yep, reasonable worst case. That's a good way to put it. I'm going to remember that terminology. So I just wanted to remind ourselves about that. And then I also just wanted to ask, you know, this project, in various forms, has been proposed and retracted and proposed my entire adult life. Going on 40 years here, I think, we've been watching the Santa Margarita Ranch and the owners decide, you know, how they would use their entitlements. So I wonder if we've ever, or if it was taken into consideration, because to me it's kind of a mitigation in and of itself for air quality, that we've taken the entitlements that the ranch originally had and created improvements to air quality, and that just the fact that it's now a cluster subdivision, the fact that the owners, and I've almost lost track of which owners put which kind of changed the plans in which ways, but at some point along the line, the owners agreed to actually move
measures they could have agreed to. We probably wouldn't ever consider them in real life, but if all the vehicles were electric, your emissions would be much lesser than what we're seeing here.
And those are the kinds of things I'm talking about, too. This is a guess at what we'll find 10 years down the road, who lives there, what's really happening in real life.
Yeah, but it's based on the assumptions that the project proponent has agreed to for the site design and all the mitigation measures that they have to select from.
And make no mistake, I'm going to be breathing that air. I would be very happy to make sure that we're doing the best job we can to mitigate for air quality. I'm just over all the years, I'm just acknowledging that a lot of things were done that maybe wouldn't even show up on the radar screen these so many years later that actually, and again, you mentioned the fact that these homes will not be located near the urban core. So I'm sure that goes the other direction on air quality mitigation. But that was a very serious wish made by the community that was acknowledged and then acted upon by the applicants. So those are the kinds of things. I just hope the applicants aren't penalized at this point for complying with the wishes of the community.
Before I recognize Mr. Meacham, let me point out that we are analyzing this project on its own merits and not in comparison to any previous proposal, whether approved or not approved by. We are looking at what the board in 2008 chose to approve, and that's it. And so we are looking at the facts as they were permitted. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. Harlan, you hit it right on the head when you said based on assumptions. I guess if it's assumed that this much, many tons are going to go into the air, is this monitored throughout the lifetime of the project?
There's mitigation measures that are incorporated in this project that I'm assuming the county will, you know, as far as the conditions of approval, be monitoring throughout the life. Off-site mitigation, monitoring that?
No.
Or?
I'm talking about the actual emissions in the time frame in which this project's going to be built. If they don't exceed those, if they're even less than what's been assumed, do they get a refund?
If they don't fully build out the project,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
No, I'm saying about if the assumptions that we have for the project, if they don't meet what those emissions are, do they get a refund for that? Because we're basing these on an assumption of what is projected out for a number of years, and we don't know what that would be. So I guess I'm looking at it from both sides of this.
Supervisor Meacham, Steve McMaster, County Planning. We do have monitoring. We will have monitoring for certain aspects, for instance, the construction phase, those sorts of things, to assure that the project is within those thresholds. I think what you're talking about is the modeling for assumptions for the number of trips and the types of vehicles that are driven, and that's really more governed by the model and the state's projections for clean fleet. We are not going to be monitoring the daily trips of all the residents in the future to find which ones have 10 trips a day and which ones have 20 or which ones have 3. I think we're allowing kind of the larger projections that the traffic models typically use for the type of development, and we're using those standards and assuming that those will be relatively consistent over the life of the project, because that's really going to change.
Okay. We wouldn't have this problem. My great-great-grandfather would have just lifted it to me.
Yeah. we'll assume that, Mr. Meacham, and, you know, but, again, we have to deal with the reality. Let me just add to the conversation on mitigation fees. It is the way mitigation fees work. I mean, in every project in which we assess mitigation fees, and there are many over the years that we've brought forward, we have to make an estimate. You can call it an assumption, you can call it a projection, you can call it a model, but the nature of what we are doing under CEQA is to, based on substantial evidence in the record, make an estimate of environmental impacts, have reasonable thresholds of significance. These are all terms of art within CEQA practice, and it is allowed to charge a fee to mitigate those impacts. We make a calculation based on best available information. The fee is paid. The fact that mitigations go into place are monitored, but there comes a point at which the level of assumptions cannot be monitored, and we are left to make things move forward in that manner. Ms. Arnold, are you back up?
Just one clarification question. And I think this is a Rob question. You mentioned that the key threshold was the annual 25 tons a year. So is that's really the compliance number that we're looking at, and the rest is discretion kind of? You use discretion in your mitigation. It could be an errant question too. I don't, daily, using the daily pounds per day is a
5 ton per year for non-attainment pollutants of precursors. And they also had the application of best available control technologies for sources that are 25 pounds per day or greater. So based on the California Health and Safety Code, that's the recommendations we brought to our board in 2009 when we approved the two-tier system. So it's based on reaching attainment with the state standards. And what we, based on the guidance from the state, what we feel is necessary for new development that's being proposed for our area to reach. These standards are also applied to stationary sources that we permit. So it's consistent with the same way we evaluated our permit stationary sources versus providing recommendations to lead agencies that have discretionary approval over land use projects.
So if the project was only going to reach 24 per day, or it's ironic that the numbers are the same, 24 per year tons, 24 per day. Anyway, if they got just below the threshold, we wouldn't even be talking about this fee. Is that correct?
That's the nature of significance thresholds under the CEQA umbrella. That's the benchmark that we use in evaluating all projects. And we have different benchmarks for different pollutants. In the ozone precursor world, we're talking 25s.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
And I think it's important to clarify staff response is that the key threshold we're discussing here is 25 pounds per day, not 25 tons per year.
Correct.
That is the trigger upon which we start this calculation.
Correct.
We know that there does exist a 25-ton-per-year threshold.
Right.
And it has been brought into the conversation in a way that we can decide is rational or not.
Correct.
Or has a rationale or not.
Yes, the Air Pollution Control Board approved it as far as a relationship, because a 25-ton-per-year was our benchmark for offsite mitigation. However, we didn't want to lose the opportunity to secure additional emission reductions from the projects that emit fewer emissions but still exceed our 25-pound-per-day threshold.
And cause significant problems in the process with ozone in certain areas. So, with that, unless staff has something important at this point,
no, go ahead.
Let me open it to the public. This is an ongoing piece of the history of a project that we've had great deal of discussion at this board. Let me ask the two parties to the lawsuit about how much time they think they need to present. For the applicant, will three minutes do it? All right, so we'll just, and if North County Watch, do you have more than 3 minutes?
I'd like
five?
Five or so.
Let me give both parties 5 minutes, and we'll start with the applicant and follow with North County Watch. Ms. Kirk speaking for the applicant. Followed by Sue Harvey, and then I have two other requests to speak.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson. Members of the board, my name is Jamie Kirk, and I am here representing Santa Margarita Ranch. I will keep my comments much briefer than the last time I was at the board on this project. As in this instance, we are in agreement with the staff recommendation. The staff recommendation is going to allow us as well as the county to comply with the writ that has been issued in our judgment. And the only suggestion that we have is we've provided council with some modifications to the findings, and it's really just augmenting the findings of approval. It's not changing them in any way. It's just adding more information into the record so that if this action, whatever action is taken today, if an action is taken, that we have as solid findings as we can. So we think that the additions benefit both us as well as the county. With that, the discussion on the equity ratio, this isn't a new issue. This has come up during the draft addendum, whenever that was released, as well in subsequent letters. County staff has responded to that in the response to comments. Our air quality expert has responded to them as well. This equity ratio is part of the methodologies, adopted methodologies of APCD that their board adopted, which all of you sit on that board, as I understand. So this is a fee calculation that's been adopted by the board. So we would like to request that you move with the staff recommendation with the findings, additional findings that we've included, and move forward and allow us to continue to comply with the writ. And we're available for questions. We have our counsel present, as well as Dennis Larson, who's assisted us in the technical review of the air quality information, because it can be very complicated. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Kirk. Ms. Harvey, and then we'll follow with Eric Greening and then David Blakely.
Thank you. Susan Harvey, North County Watch, and we're the plaintiff in this. Air quality isn't an incidental item. It's necessary for your life. Poor air quality shortens life and causes premature death. It makes life miserable for children and adults with breathing issues. I'd like to also talk about a little bit about the issue of attainment. Both the FEIR and the addendum make strong statements that this area is an area of non-attainment in ozone precursors and particulate matter. And the standard of review for CEQA is that any reasonable person looking at an environmental document can understand what the issues are. Any reasonable person reading these would come to the conclusion that the county is an area of non-attainment and that the air quality issues need to be fully mitigated. I'd like to talk a little bit about this. You have a copy of this, but a study from 2009, the University of California, and on the impacts of ozone and particulate matter. This is the first time we've been able to connect chronic exposure to ozone, one of the most widespread pollutants in the world, with risk of death, arguably the most important outcome in health impact studies used to justify air quality regulations. Previous research has connected short-term or acute ozone exposure to impaired lung function, aggravated asthma symptoms, increased emergency room visits, and hospitalization. But the impact of long-term exposure to ozone on mortality has not been pinned down until now. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we want to look at why we are advocating for mitigating for even the 25 pounds. And, of course, the question is, if you're going to work with the 25 pound, 25 tons a year, why not just then divide that by 365? Why do we have a daily impact? And if we have the importance of a daily impact, then why aren't we mitigating for it in the fully mitigating for it? Some more quotes from this. A National Council report concluded that premature death related to ozone exposure of less than 24 hours are more likely among those with pre-existing conditions. As has been observed in previous studies, researchers found that fine particulate matter was linked to an increased risk of death from cardiovascular causes when analyzed alone and with ozone. The new findings was that the effects of ozone remain strongly linked to the risk of death from respiratory problems, even after fine particulate pollution has been taken into account. I really appreciate all the time that you gave me to talk about these issues and with staff. I'm going to give you this because this is just a copy of some of my comments, and we are asking that you mitigate for the full impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. With that, we'll go to the general public. Mr. Greening, followed by David Blakely.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I'm not a general, but I am a citizen. And I support the request of North County Watch. When the Air Pollution Control District adopted the current methodology, several things that have happened since, and we don't know what's going to happen next. The current oil glut, the current dropping in the price of gasoline, the current rise, quite a spike in the sales of SUVs. Some of the projections about driver behavior may not be accurate. And what we are looking at, yes, it is at the behest of the community, but it is a leapfrog development. And I think we need to, we should not set a precedent for coddling future leapfrog developments, whether they use the cluster ordinance or whatever, in terms of truly fully mitigating their impacts. Some of the impacts of having a leapfrog development in that location, you have a population of kids living surrounded by agriculture, but in a suburban neighborhood. In other words, they're not living the life, the involving life of farm kids. They're living the life of suburban kids surrounded by land that is attractive to them, but where they would be trespassing if they went there. So they will be seeking suburban-type connections. They may be in some kind of program after school, dramatics, athletics, who knows what, and need to get home after the school bus. They may just want to visit friends in town. We have an existing mitigation, as I understand it, that is not being changed here, of a trail to town that would let them get to and from. And I think a very useful way of using some of the mitigation money, and I hope at the higher level, would be to upgrade this to a Class 1 bikeway so that it is...
And Supervisor Ray, I think you are justifiably proud of the success of the athletic programs from a couple of high schools in your districts. But Frank, I'm very impressed that you can still wear your letter jacket. There's no way in heck that I could wear anything that I was wearing when I was in high school.
It's not original
it's
issue.
Not original. Oh, okay. And I know Supervisor Ray didn't go to Napomo High School because it didn't exist, I think, when she was a student. Nonetheless, I'm here today asking your board to base the mitigations for air quality impacts as a result of the Santa Margarita Agricultural Residential Cluster Subdivision on the total amount of air pollution estimated to be created by this project, and not just the small fraction of air pollution estimated to be above the 25 pounds per year, as determined by this study as a threshold of significance. The project should mitigate for the full 35.31 tons, not just the 6.42 tons over the threshold. I think I understand the 5.5 equity factor and why that's in place. My compliments to your staff for spending time trying to explain all of this to me, and they really went out of their way to make sure that I understood what were in these reports. So thank you for having such an excellent staff. Didn't want to get into that $1,000 you're giving them, but I think it's a good idea. I also understand how the rate was determined as a result of the Carl Moyer program. If you've got to use something, Carl Moyer probably gives you as good of a number as anything for determining the cost per ton for air pollution. But I do not accept the 25 pounds per day threshold. Now, another thing is this discussion has been focusing on these off-site mitigations, and I know at least one of you supervisors is not thrilled about off-site mitigations. And I think it might behoove your board to take a look at on-site mitigations to help reduce the impacts. There's been no discussion of that. Nobody's looking at that, and I think that there are opportunities on-site to mitigate these air quality impacts, such things as reducing the number of houses to get below the 25 pounds per year, additional restrictions on wood-burning stoves, park and ride lots to help with vehicles. There's tons of things that your staff has got a lot of expertise as that can provide you with some on-site mitigations if you don't like the whole notion of off-site mitigations. Now, the reason we're here, boy, the time goes so quickly. Look at the clock. Anyway, please mitigate the entire 35.3 tons. I think that that is the real impact. Air quality is so important. I think that we must do everything we can to protect it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blakely. With that, I have no further requests to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board for deliberation. And let me first ask if staff had any specific responses they wanted to make of out of public comment here.
I don't believe we have any responses.
All right.
Bob does.
Thank you. All right. I'll recognize Supervisor of the District if she would like to start.
I'll go after.
All right. Then Ms. Ray.
I have some follow-up questions. First of all, Aaron, can you comment on the comment that was made by one of the or by the appellant that this is an area of non-attainment? Is that referring to the entire county or just this basin?
The entire county is non-attainment for the state ozone standard. The eastern part of the county, and what we talk a lot about at our board, is non-attainment for the federal standard.
Okay.
This project is not within the federal non-attainment region, but just the entire county, which is not meeting the state standard.
Okay. And can you also explain why there's a difference between the daily threshold and the annual threshold? In other words, why is it that we don't just take the annual threshold and divide it by 365?
That's a really good question. In the 2009 handbook, we actually had three thresholds. And with more thresholds, I think we can see today that it's quite confusing for everyone involved. And perhaps in our next handbook update, our board will consider one threshold. The reason we have the two thresholds today is to be able to mitigate different projects differently. As defined in our CEQA handbook, based on the total emissions of a project, we're recommending a different amount of mitigation measures be incorporated into the project. And for those projects that exceed the 25 pound per day threshold and it goes up, I'd have to look at the table. It's table 3-4 of our mitigation threshold guide. If it's less than 25 pounds per day, there's no mitigation since it doesn't exceed our significant threshold. And then it ramps up 25 to 29 pounds per day. It recommends a number of mitigation. And then there's a column for off-site mitigation with an asterisk. And that's where we get into the discretion of the lead agency whether you want to impose off-site mitigation for those projects that exceed the 25 pound per day. We recommend that the lead agency consider additional mitigation to reduce those impacts.
And then let me ask a little bit of it's going to sound like an easy question. It may not be. Regarding on-site mitigations, if possible, what would the elimination of wood-burning stoves do to the number?
It would significantly reduce the emissions. I don't have the calculations.
Would that get them under the threshold and eliminate the fee?
Well, you can see on the table here.
When you say here, where are you looking?
I'm sorry. right here.
Right there. Supervisor Ray, she's right there.
I'm sorry, this is in the addendum, attachment 2, table 1. This is where we looked at the emissions, or where RINCON looked at the emissions over the entire course of the year, separating out when the wood stoves were used in the wintertime and when they aren't being used, and then the summer months. You would have to do a similar analysis here for no wood stoves across the entire winter season.
What page are you on?
I'm sorry.
It's page 239 of our consolidated staff report.
Thank you very much.
I see page 8 and I see page 13.
I got there both ways.
12.
All right, good. Thank you. So as you can tell, I'm probably the one in the middle here. So I'm still trying to determine where I'm at on this. So not going through all those numbers, but just as a quick and easy question. Again, so the elimination of the wood-burning stoves would drop this to a level that would not reach significance. Is that correct?
0.76. I would have to do the calculations. I don't.
Well, maybe I'll go ahead and do that, and I'll ask my last question. I took the page that was given to us by North County Watch, and I handed it over to County Council to take a look at it. And so I thought maybe they could comment on some of the things that were in there.
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. The calculation of mitigation fee that the staff has presented you is based on the APCD's handbook, as we've gone through today. So if the board agrees that the proper way to calculate the air quality mitigation for this project is to follow that handbook and to reach those same calculations, then we disagree with the conclusion of this letter that it would result in there continuing to be Class 1 significant impacts, because we think at that point we would have eliminated them.
So once we determine what the appropriate calculation is and the court approves that calculation, then by definition we have mitigated the Class 1 impact. Is that correct?
No, I think the board needs to convince itself that it has enough evidence before it to agree that the Class 1 impacts have been mitigated to a level of insignificance, because we're not in a position where we're making any kind of override here. We're using an addendum to proceed with the project. So and you would need to conclude that the staff has presented you enough evidence and convinced you of how to make the calculation, and you've done that in a way that eliminates those impacts.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right.
Is Aaron back with the...
Was there further...
Supervisor Ray, I can answer your question.
Okay.
Regarding, if elimination of, for example, the wood-burning stoves would reduce emissions below threshold, of course we would have to recalculate that to see exactly what it would be, but it's estimated to be about a 20 to 30% reduction, so I don't think on its face value that we would get below threshold.
It won't, because the days in the winter when woods, in your middle column you have an exceedance, and in your
correct.
And in your summer days you have an exceedance. So it's really just taking 183 times 10.01, and you see what the winter contribution would be.
Yeah, I think it roughly reduces it by about a ton.
Yeah,
but you're still
exactly.
exceeding by 1.56 tons.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I don't need the numbers. I just need the yes or the no.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any further commentary? With no requests to speak, let me say I'm still convinced that that in applying this equity ratio, we are not on a solid rationale for determining this mitigation as a number. I think there are some ways of getting some change here, but let me start by saying this is the first I've heard of the equity factor. This is the first project where the equity factor has reached my attention span. And, yes, I sat on the board of the APCD when we approved the CEQA handbook. But I'd like Ms. Arlen-Janet to confirm to me that beyond the citation that Mr. Fitzroy provided us, there's no discussion of the development of that rationale. You pointed to me to a place on page 3-21 of the CEQA handbook. There's no other discussion in the CEQA handbook where that 5.5 comes from that I saw.
It's just referencing the value of the equity ratio and the intent.
Right. So as such, it
we have that in
that. I think it was also found inconsistent with the APCD's clean air plan. And I do remember that the APCD supported the denial that staff brought forward. The concern I have is that if you go to table one that we've been looking at. If we apply the equity ratio and reduce 2.64 tons, which comes out of a very clear calculation, 2.64 tons is what's above the 25-pound-a-day threshold, to a mere 0.48, in essence, we are changing the threshold of significance. What we've decided is that instead of mitigating everything above 25 pounds per day, if you do a little math, you can come up with the fact that what we're asking this project to do is mitigate for anything above 36.8 pounds per day. And again, I don't see a solid rationale for shifting the threshold. Either we use 25 pounds per day or we use 25 tons per year. That's what's in our CEQA handbook. And to come up with this application with a significant lack of rationale bothers me. I believe the 25 pounds per day threshold is appropriate because ozone is a serious issue in this part of the county. We have had exceedances in the past. We are likely to have exceedances in the future because the standard for ozone is going to be reduced. And ozone occurs on specific days. Ozone is a matter of wood smoke in the air taking us over a threshold and causing a problem. That's how the exceedances occur in that part of North County. So I get it if we want to decide that perhaps multiplying 2.64 tons times $17,000 a ton is too much. I do think we're on much better basis of sticking with the 2.64 and changing the number of dollars we charge this project to mitigate a ton. And, in discussions with APCD staff, we have seen over the years projects that come in and mitigate a ton of various criteria pollutants, or particularly ozone precursors, at less than 17,000. So I think this board would be on better footing to decide that 10,000 or 12,000 or some other number is the appropriate mitigation fee to charge for the actual calculated exceedances. So that's where I would like to see this go. We'll continue the discussion with Ms. Arnold, followed by Mr. Hill.
Do you want to go first?
No, please.
Well, all right. You know, I get a little windy when the districts are it's in my district, but here goes. So I want to say a few things about this project. I mentioned that this has been going on, that the Santa Margarita Ranch and the decisions surrounding it, the varied proposed projects have been going on for 40 years. I think, David, both of us have been involved, and here we still are. So you'll appreciate what I have to say, I think, and maybe. But over the many years, there have been a lot of different proposals, and it's really evolved. In my opinion, this is not my favorite. The ending is not the way I would have written the book, nor is it the worst option in terms of those of us that live out there and what we wanted to see in the ranch. Although every proposal had its pros and cons. And originally, in my recollection of this so long ago, is that the original owners, the first owners that proposed development of the ranch would have grown the town of Santa Margarita by hundreds of homes and really enlarged the town. Of course, the developers at that time offered a lot of amenities to the town, sewer probably being the biggest, parks and all kinds of things. But that was not the wishes of the people that lived around that area, and they successfully kind of fought back and forth and repressed that from ever happening. At one time, the ranch was proposed for conservation easement, similar to the successful conservation of the Hearst Ranch, I had hoped. And that, I'll have to admit, was my favorite proposal over the years, that the ranch would have been conserved. But opposition to the details of the conservation pretty much killed that possibility. And so now, this is the proposal after all these many years that are before us, and this is actually one of the last details to be worked out before we see the ending, I think, of what will happen to the ranch in probably our lifetimes. So I agreed with a lot of the speakers, and I want to say that Sue Harvey mentioned, and North County Watcher, she's speaking for them, and I agreed with a lot of her points. This could certainly be called this cluster development sprawl. But the double density, I don't know if I had sat here at the time, if that would have been something that I agreed to. And it's always hindsight, it's always easy. But at the time, development blocking their view, and it was an ask by the community to send it out there and locate it in a place where it really isn't going to be visible. So that was another trade-off, the view shed or the visibility of this development to be put in a place where it really wouldn't interfere with the views that everyone's kind of come to love that live there now. So all that being said, in this case, I have one more thing to say. And this is always a lot of folks are speaking, and Supervisor Gibson as well, that this area of the county is an area of non-attainment. I was surprised to hear the first time that the eastern part of our county was an area of non-attainment. I thought, what? That's the least populated area in the county, or one of them. But really, that is the reason is due to drift from Kern County. It's something we can't control in this county. We almost get a benefit for the drift because it enables us to get funding for projects, alternative transportation projects, et cetera. But if we are in non-attainment in the eastern part of our county, it is not our pollution. It's coming. It's drift from Kern County. So I'm really happy that Aaron brought up the future of automobile travel and the technology that's going to create cleaner ways to travel. And I'm looking forward to all of that. I'm not in this project, in this particular project, more than anything I've talked about since I've been a supervisor. This is not something I feel like I'm talking about other people dealing with. This is my backyard too, and this is my town. These are my kids that go to school there, and everything. So I am taking all that into consideration. But the staff recommendations use fee calculations that were adopted by the APCD. I think, you know, when landowners, they depend on us to give them the rules, and then they try to work around them. In this case, these applicants have been working for, I think the first time we saw this project was maybe 8, maybe 10 years ago. So this has been a long time trying to come into compliance. Again, these are fee calculations that have been adopted by our Air Pollution Control District. And with that, I'd like to make a motion today to accept staff's recommendations.
I'll second it. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Under discussion, then, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Supervisor Arnold in the sense that, you know, I would have preferred to see something else proposed, with conservation being certainly at the top of the list, and maybe some other ideas after that would have developed this in a way that was certainly more consistent with our own plan and our own general plan and our own probably values. I think, you know, having sat through those hearings as an elect but not a sworn-in supervisor, it was probably the worst episode I can remember in the history of the county and maybe one of the worst abuses of power that hopefully we'll never revisit. That said, the recourse for that was the court. And in this case, the court made a decision that is very limited and very, very much, you know, sort of looking at a few areas that needed to be revisited in the EIR and without overturning the decision or looking at other areas, and that's what we have to live with. I see where Supervisor Gibson, because I have similar questions about it, but I don't have any alternatives as to, you know, I think it's a very complicated rationale that our professional staff at APCD has come up with in terms of coming up with this, you know, coming up with this mitigation. I can't think of an alternative way to go about it. I don't know that this is in any sense, and if it was, I guess the judge, it's still in the jurisdiction of the court. So if this was really faulty, obviously there's an opportunity for the judge to, if I'm not correct, please correct me, Mr. McNulty, the judge could have does have the discretion to say, well, this doesn't work. Or he's already said, I guess this is probably okay.
So, to McNulty, the place we're at now is the fee amount that was imposed on this project for air mitigation was looked at by the court. It was based on a South County air quality mitigation fee, and that was something that had been suggested by the project proponents at the hearing on the subdivision back in 2008, I think it was, whenever that was. The court found that there really wasn't any substantial evidence supporting that fee, which was a really modest fee. And the court directed us to come back with something that is supportable and that can be supported by substantial evidence. And that's what the attempt to do was by, you know, the staff preparing and circulating the addendum, getting comments on it, trying to make this calculation. So what we're really trying to do is to come arrive at the right fee number and convince the court that there's evidence to support that number, because the previous number was
caused by the site itself and the development on the site. It seems quite practical to do things like put this mitigation money into things like bike lanes from the project to the town and et cetera, so that you would, you know, there's an obvious nexus here between what pollution the project may cause and how to best mitigate it within the realm of the project area. And if you can get more people on bikes and less people out of their cars to go into town and et cetera, that would seem to me much more appropriate than just saying, well, in the general basin area, that's where the money will be applied. And I don't know, Tim's going to weigh in.
Supervisor Hill, I think if that's the direction that the board is interested in going, I'm not sure that you're there with what's being proposed today. You might want to have the staff comment on whether or not those are things that could be funded by this money and whether or not funding those things would adequately mitigate these impacts. I don't know that that's the case.
Well, I guess I would ask the motion maker in the second if they would support staff coming up with on-site mitigations that would truly, in the direct area of the development, you know, along the lines of things, you know, I think you're getting into too many fights if you're going to start reducing home sites and taking away, you know, wood burning and et cetera, where you might look at the kind of things that we're trying to push forward in all communities, which is increased use of biking and pedestrian use that might get people out of cars. And I don't know if that's something that staff can apply today, but I think it would be more sensible in support of the motion.
Go ahead, Ms. Arnold. If you want to respond, I was going to give staff a chance to respond to that if they wished. Certainly we'll go to
sure.
Ms. Arnold.
Yeah. I'll let Aaron go first.
As far as the offsite mitigation funds and the way they would be used, APCD staff would evaluate options that are available to reduce like-for-like emissions, and our goal is always to reduce it as close to the project site as possible. This is something we did at our last board meeting as it related to the Los Osos wastewater treatment plant. Historically, with our experience in evaluating different types of projects, when you look at the air quality benefits and the cost of establishing a Class 1 bike lane, they don't pencil out, unfortunately. So we wouldn't be able to meet the goals of reducing the emissions that are defined here in this report with a bike lane expansion project. The projects that are more cost-effective are replacing a fireplace with a gas insert, for example. Those are extremely cost-effective, working with the neighboring community. those reduce ozone precursors that we're needing to reduce here. Other things are getting the old high-polluting vehicles off the road. But staff develops the calculations that are necessary to reduce necessary emissions. We then present it to our board, and our board takes action on staff's recommendations.
Bike lane's more fun than a gas insert, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is, Ms.
Supervisor Arnold, anything?
And Aaron answered most of my question. I mean, I was looking at the off-site mitigation list, and it included a lot of things that Supervisor Hill was talking about. The question was just, do you look first to the area that you're trying to mitigate? And, of course, you just answered that question. Quick question, though. Is it possible, or does APCD ever use the mitigation money in conjunction with SLOCOG, for example? Because I know, in fact, the ranch itself has dedicated a trail, and they'll, in other words, do you ever work together with other agencies to put the money towards existing project trail projects, bike lanes, et cetera, that may be improvements to that?
We do partner with other agencies, and going back to our last board meeting, we worked with SLOCOG and expanding the iRideShare program.
Yep.
I hate to say it, but bike lanes and trails don't pencil out on the cost effectiveness front.
Okay.
They do more for other mitigation that's identified through the NIR process. They have a benefit. They're very fun and enticing to do, but unfortunately, a lot of people that live in this new development, how many of those are actually going to be biking to work in Santa Margarita? So for the air quality quantification that we have to calculate, it's the essential trips and making sure that you have justification for defining the air quality benefit of those measures.
Well, I liked your suggestion of replacing old wood burning stoves, because depending on the inversion layer in Santa Margarita, you really can, you could see that there could be some improvement there. So that certainly would be. But one quick thing that I missed in my motion was to include the suggested additions to the resolution and to Exhibit A that the applicant had given us.
Does the second agree with that?
Maybe we should have counsel.
Yeah.
If the board is going to proceed with the motion, then I think it's appropriate to include those additions to the resolution.
But I think that discussion should take place with the ones that are going to exact the mitigation monies and the developer, to see if there's something that could supplement something that they were doing that would help with a project of some sort. But I absolutely think that on-site mitigations are much better than sending the money off someplace else, because there's a lot of things that they have to do. And then I guess and Arlen, you hit it on the head before, as I mentioned, a lot of this is based upon assumptions. We don't know. We're assuming that these certain things are going to happen, and we hope they don't exceed that. And that's why I was curious about the monitoring aspect of it. But at this particular point, I do support the motion.
And if I might, Ms. Ray, let me ask staff about, planning staff in particular, about on-site mitigations, because in theory we have applied all the feasible on-site mitigations already in conditioning this project. Or am I wrong? Is there potential within the conditions of this project to seek more on-site mitigation?
Correct. The EIR did require on-site mitigation. The EIR went beyond that here with the off-site mitigation.
Okay. So it's only
based on the proposed project. We did the EIR did include, to the extent feasible, on-site mitigation.
The greatest extent. Thank you, Mr. Meacham.
And I guess that kind of goes back to Supervisor Ray's point too, though. If this amount of money were put back into the project for on-site mitigations, would that reduce the emissions to the point that they'd be below where the threshold is?
Should I go?
Go ahead.
Want to arm wrestle?
Don't do it.
Ladies first.
One thing that I could state as far as implementation of on-site mitigation, and I tend to go back to our last board meeting where we worked within the community of Los Osos for the mitigation measures there, it's definitely an option that we would have. Looking at the on-site or the off-site mitigation funds that are available and the amount of emissions that we need to reduce, what is available on site that we could secure additional mitigation from that's not included in the EIR? It would have to go above and beyond what's already calculated for the EIR. One aspect that comes to mind is an electric vehicle charging station. That's something that we incorporated downtown Los Osos. Maybe for this project, it might not be best served in the residential development itself, but in close proximity where both the residents and the residents in Santa Margarita could benefit from EV charging station to expand the use of EVs further throughout the community.
Because they do have park and ride, I think, in Santa Margarita.
Thank you. Let me go to Ms. Ray and then back to Ms. Arnold.
I'm still unclear about the wood-burning stove part of this. Are we building houses with wood-burning stoves here or not?
So the project description, as it was proposed, assumes that a certain number of the homes would be built with wood-burning stoves.
Okay, so this is the part where I'm not clear. So we're going to mitigate for impacts that have not occurred yet because we don't know if there's wood-burning stoves, so we're going to give an offset because of, again, something that doesn't exist that you're going to substitute out. That doesn't make sense to me as far as a mitigation is concerned.
We calculated the emissions based on the project description, and the project was conditioned with the use of EPA or APCD-certified wood-burning devices that meet our rule. So the assumption is wood stoves will be incorporated into the residential units throughout.
And but then they'll be able to get an offsite or an on-site mitigation for not including that in the future?
No. The assumptions are based on what the project description states.
So they wouldn't be able to achieve an on-site mitigation via removal of wood-burning stoves?
If these, it's very unlikely that these brand new homes would be built with an open hearth fireplace and then want to elect to replace it with a gas insert. So the offsite mitigation would go to the existing community that's neighboring this proposed project.
So we're going to build them here but remove them there?
It's air pollution benefit that we can secure in close proximity.
Mm-hmm. That seems odd to me.
Well, let me, if I might, Supervisor Ray, I think your inclination.
Well, I'm not quite done yet, so if you would let me finish, sure. And then we'll go to that. The last piece that I wanted to, on the other side of my argument, you can tell I'm kind of all over the place today, is that I am in general agreement that this is the methodology that we should use with regard to the fee, because it has to be based on substantial evidence. And so I am there, but I'm not there with regard to the on-site versus off-site mitigations, because I just what we're doing to here with that seems to me to be counterintuitive.
So what I was going to offer, Ms. Ray, is that you had the inclination of what might happen if wood, and they may well be able to directly fund projects that reduce ozone precursors at much less than $17,000 a ton. They could certainly pursue that, and I'd ask staff or council to correct me if I'm wrong on that. So that's a way to reduce the amount. It remains that we have calculated that the actual amount of emissions over the threshold is 2.64 tons per year. How we get those reduced, I think there are a variety. That was the alternative I was going to offer, and then I'll recognize Ms. Arnold.
Thank you. In this case, because this is so close to home, I want to make it clear. I know for a fact that today's wood stoves are not the open hearth. It's not even allowed. I mean, planning or Aaron or somebody can share this. You cannot build the wood-burning fireplaces that many houses in Santa Margarita have today. But today, if you want anything that's wood-burning, I believe the woods come in little tiny pellets, and it's more EPA-approved and et cetera, et cetera.
They don't have to be pellet stoves. They can be wood-burning devices, but they do have to meet APCD and EPA emission standards.
So it's very, very different. And all of the things that we're talking about have been taken into account. But I would appreciate allowing APCD to have the flexibility in this case, because the town of Santa Margarita, because of its age, the age of the town, Frank, you go back further than I did.
I wasn't there when it was
tell us about the old days. And so, but the age of the homes, many of the homes, there is a lot of good work that can be done with the money. And I mean, I have complete confidence in APCD and would appreciate allowing them the flexibility. Just in this short amount of time we've been discussing, Aaron's already brought up the electric car, whatever we call it, the
charging
station. Well, couldn't say that. Perfect spot off the 101 in Santa Margarita where everyone in the area would be able to utilize something like that, not just the on-site project. And it's been said. But with today's building standards, I'm sure that this project, as these homes are being built, will be taking into account all of the improvements in technology, et cetera, et cetera. I think the real work that will benefit the whole area would be done in and around Santa Margarita. So I would like to see us just let APC do its thing, give them the flexibility to make the decision and approve the staff recommendations.
Okay. Well, it doesn't appear that colleagues are interested in direct mitigation. Let me just ask staff quickly if that is a possible tack we could take.
Supervisor Gibson, are you asking whether we could include the requirement for banning?
Whether we could structure these conditions by simply saying that the applicant shall show evidence of having funded projects to reduce ozone precursors in the amount
I can jump
calculated.
As far as offsite mitigation and the guidance that we do provide in our handbook, it's an option. If the project proponent ever was to have interest to implement their own offsite mitigation and manage those reductions and demonstrate that they're securing necessary reductions, they can do that. It's very rare that it happens, and they typically provide the funds. They're just not in the business of doing that type of emissions. But it has to be reviewed and approved by the Air District in order to ensure that it's meeting the goals.
Okay. And I don't see a groundswell, a bandwagon, or a paradigm shift coming from my colleagues as regards this matter, so I'm going to let that drop at this point. Let me offer a couple comments, and maybe we can vote the motion. I'm not going to support the motion as it's framed, as I had indicated before. I don't think we're on any better ground now than we were when the project was initially proposed. I have great respect for APCD staff, and I understand what they're trying to do with bringing forward this equity factor. And again, I'm a bit chagrined that I hadn't identified the use of that prior to today. But quite clearly, we have a bright line, 25 pounds per day, that's being exceeded here. We talked about having substantial evidence to support some change in the offsite air quality mitigation fees. I don't see that substantial evidence here. I don't believe that those fees are any better supported than they were. We'll take other comments under discussion from colleagues. Mr. Meacham?
Just quickly, if I could, and Supervisor Arnold's point about the needs around the Santa Margarita area, I just hope that you can go back to staff and know that there has been suggestion by the supervisor of the district, and I support that. If there can be mitigation measures in and around that area with the applicant, I think that would be a good thing.
Yeah, I support that too.
With that and seeing no other requests to discuss this, we'll go ahead and ask Madam Clerk for a roll call if she's clear on the motion.
I need clarity on the motion, please.
Okay.
Final motion includes the amended
staff to approve staff recommendations with the.
Which I'll need.
Yeah, you can have that.
And C. McMaster, real quick, that would be adding a 7 and 8 to the resolution and 5 and 6 to the findings in Exhibit A, as noted on the
session. We will, as traditional, begin with a report out of closed session.
Rita Neal, County Council. The board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
Thank you, ma'am. With that, I'd entertain a motion on our presentation calendar. Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Ms. Ray. Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. We are here mostly to recognize a number of remarkable people for many years of service and great contributions to this county and our communities. And in between there, we're also going to talk a little bit about the future of one of our most important and beloved auxiliary institutions, the San Luis Obispo County Children and Families Commission. Easier to call it First Five. We're actually going to start in that vein. We have resolutions recognizing Dr. Julian Crocker and Susan Hughes, who have been more than important pillars of this operation. We'll start with a resolution for Dr. Crocker. If you would take the lectern, Supervisor Ray is going to read that.
And before I read that, I just want to say that it has been such a pleasure to have worked with Dr. Crocker both in the political world and the educational world. And he was part of my professional upbringing as one of my former professors. So it is my pleasure to read this for you. Resolution recognizing Julian D. Crocker for 25 years of service in San Luis Obispo County. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas Julian D. Crocker began his career in public education in 1964 as a classroom teacher, and whereas Julian advanced to principal in both the elementary and middle school settings, whereas Julian completed his doctorate in educational administration from Harvard University in 1972, whereas Julian was elected as the San Luis Obispo County Superintendent of Schools in 1998, beginning his term in 1999, and has ran unopposed for four consecutive terms, whereas Julian was instrumental in the authorization of the first charter for the Grizzly Challenge Charter School in San Luis Obispo, partnering with the California National Guard to provide a six-month intense residential program for at-risk students, and whereas Julian is a champion for our youngest children, birth to age five, providing advocacy throughout the state for quality child care and preschool opportunities for all children, and has been a member of the First Five Commission, San Luis Obispo County, since its inception in 1999, and whereas Julian will retire on January 2nd, 2015, and is looking forward to spending time with his wife Donna and children and six grandchildren. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize and thank Julian D. Crocker for 25 years of exemplary service to the students, teachers, and school administrators of San Luis Obispo County, and wishes him the best of health and happiness in his retirement.
You have a multi-camera photo op here, which you actually three cameras is good, Julian.
Yeah. Crockerazzi.
Well done. We're welcome. Yeah. So
if I could just say one thing.
Oh, absolutely.
I've always said that generally, you know, if parents and if schools and if the community, if we do our jobs, generally our students will be successful. So I really appreciate the work of the county, you as leadership in terms of our community, in terms of schools, and particularly a couple of your departments, the Social Services Department, Health Department in particular, just been great partners with not only the County Office of Education, but also with our local school district. So on behalf of the 35,000 students that go to our schools, we thank you very much, and thank you very much for this.
Well, Julian, it's been beyond a pleasure to work with you. I think the County Office of Education is perhaps less known than its importance would suggest it should be, and the connections that you have with so many different things that go on in this county, and particularly in county government. Your office interacts with a lot of different departments here, looking always out for the welfare of our youngest members of our society. Part of the timing of this is, as the audience probably is not surprised to know, this is not the first recognition of a long and distinguished career that Julian has proceeded, but the timing here is particularly coordinated with our recognition of Susan and other aspects of the First Five, and it's been my pleasure to serve with you on that commission. I have been designated to take over as the chair of that, and in looking at your career and the best, Supervisor Hill to read this.
My pleasure to read this for a friend and former neighbor, Susan. I see her husband's here as well. This is recognizing Susan Hughes' 27 years of service in our county. The following resolution is hereby offered and read. Whereas Susan K. Hughes brought her talents to San Luis Obispo County in 1987 following a successful prior career in radio broadcasting, and whereas San Luis Obispo County's AIDS Support Network and County Tobacco Control Program grew and prospered under her visionary leadership and care, whereas Susan served as first five San Luis Obispo County's founding executive directors since 1998, guiding the organization in service to its mission to allocate funds and advocate for quality programs and services designed to ensure that every young child is healthy and ready to learn. And whereas over a decade and a half, Susan has deftly administered nearly $25 million in first five funds that have been invested in San Luis Obispo County's children to provide critical programs and services in health, early education, and family support that have benefited thousands of children and families. Whereas having served as one of our community's greatest champions for children, Susan is entering a well-deserved retirement where it is certain she will continue to share her many gifts with the community in new ways, in between walks with her dog Barkley, who I know, and travel adventures with her family. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize and thank Susan K. Hughes for her 27 years of exemplary service in San Luis Obispo County and wishes her the best of health and happiness in her retirement. Susan? Get Stephen, her loyal husband, to come on up and join her here. You got all these paparazzi. You got to get in.
Yeah, really. Oh my gosh. The word's gotten out. We got more cameras now. So
he's not camera shy.
All right.
Of course, I have to just say a couple of things.
Please.
Thank you so much for this honor. I'm humbled by it, and it was totally unexpected. To be alongside Dr. Crocker is not an easy task, as you know, so that makes it extra special for me. You know, I couldn't have done this without support from you all as well. You let us become an independent agency and do our kind of become more nimble and be able to really outreach and reach to those children and families like we needed to. For that, I'm grateful because it worked then more like a nonprofit and we could really be responsive. You know, I also counted up, I think I served under 22 commissioners, but not so many staff, just the current staff here and one or two others that are no longer with us. But so for that, I'm very grateful as well, because without them, I wouldn't be as successful either. So it really does take the village. And as Cacho is always, you know, you always hear him say, children are a third of our population, but all of our future, and that's so true. So one last challenge before I leave. I challenge your board to always think of kids and children as you make your difficult or easy decisions, whether it be budgets or planning or however you do things. But keep in mind those kids because they are your future, too. Thank you.
Susan, thank you very much. Mr. Meacham.
If I might, Susan, thank you so much for all the work you've done, and I do take that into consideration for all nine of my grandkids. And I know we first met in Leadership San Luis Obispo, Class 5, the one by which all others are judged.
Well, again, it's been my pleasure to overlap with Susan for a few years that I've been on the first five commission as this board's representative. It's been a tremendous education for me, and out of an idea that was brought forward at the ballot box comes a stream of money that is directed to children from 0 to 5 years old. And Susan and Julian and others like Cacho have made that program a remarkable model and have done some really good things for kids. We thank you very much. And in the spirit, as we talk about the founding members of First Five, we also, our next item is a presentation on the current status of First Five. And what I'd like to do in introducing that is to invite our new executive director of First Five, Ms. Wendy Wendt,
to come forward. Wendy started,
as many of you may know, others might not, is to allocate funds and advocate for quality programs and services supporting children prenatal to five to ensure that every child is healthy and ready to learn. That is our mantra. That's our North Star. That is what we operate under as we move forward. So just a little bit around our history. Mr. Gibson mentioned this already. In 1998, the voters enacted Proposition 10, which instituted a state tobacco tax. That revenue stream is designated to support young children and families throughout the state of California. And first five commissions in every one of our 58 counties are designated as the overseers, the stewards of those tobacco tax funds in support of programs towards health, wellness, family support, and education for young children prenatal to age five. Shortly after the act was put into motion, we founded First Five San Luis Obispo County, and as you just heard, Susan Hughes was our founding executive director. She's led us over nearly 15 years of service to the community, and in 2015, we will officially be past our 15th year as funder and advocate for the youngest among us in San Luis Obispo County. The resources that we have to work with, every year approximately 1.5, give or take, in annual state tobacco tax revenues is distributed to San Luis Obispo County. And the first five commissioners are responsible for making decisions, often very difficult, about how to make best use of those funds. Our investments currently support over 20 programs across five initiative areas, and you can see what these are: school readiness, health, oral health, perinatal substance abuse prevention, and special needs. We also engage in a number of shared community advocacy efforts, some of which you've heard about and, in fact, have endorsed, including the first ever Children's Bill of Rights for San Luis Obispo County, the annual Hands-On Heroes Awards. And by the way, if I can make a little plug, the next annual Hands-On Heroes Awards banquet is coming up on April 23rd. Nominations are open, so if you have people in your districts who you feel deserve honor as advocates and supporters for young children in various fields of health, early childhood education, and care, by all means, take a look at our website, and you can see how to nominate a hero. And we've recently instituted a new, with some of our partners, a new P5 Children's Advocacy Network to engage in shared advocacy for the youngest children in our community across health, education, and other sectors. These are our commissioners, and some of them are here today. Commissioners, if you are in the audience, do you mind standing up so they can see who you are? We have Bruce Gibson in front of us, Penny Borenstein representing County Health Agency, Lee Collins, Department of Social Services. Oh, Julian, you're in parentheses. I didn't know what to do. You have not officially instated Dr. Jim Brescia. He will be on your January 6th agenda to officially bring into the fold. But for now, we have this parenthetical. Melinda Sekulowski, representing County Child Care Planning Council, Tracy Shiro, Children's Services Network, Mike McNerney from American Academy of Pediatrics up in North County, and then two community representatives at large, Janet Murphy and Mary Kern. Okay. And without further ado, we thought we would show you a brief video that's currently on our website. This is also by way of encouraging all of you to check out the website. There's a lot of really wonderful information there, but this is a video that was recently put together to share with our community what First Five is all about.
Services such as breastfeeding education, supporting parents with children with special needs, and improving access to health care and social services. diversified school readiness programs provide quality early care and education. There are many more important programs that are supported by First Five in our community. First Five advocates for services that benefit early childhood development. Since 2000, more than $24 million have been invested in quality programs for children in San Luis Obispo County. In 2013, First Five took the lead to create a local children's bill of rights.
North County with the school readiness program at Georgia Brown Elementary School. So, Dan, nice to meet you.
Good afternoon. Indeed. Hey, how you doing, Frank? Real quick, our program that we started probably more than a decade ago is extremely important, I feel. 70% of everything kids learn takes place through their visual system. So ensuring that these kids are ready to learn visually is extremely important. I see kids all the way from Napomo to Cambria, all the way out to Carissa Plains and some of the underserved areas of the county, which do exist. About 4,000, 4,500, I think we've been doing the past few years. The lucky ones actually get caught by the Lions Club, first, third, fifth grade, which is a great program all by itself. But so many of these kids have profound problems, really from birth. And we're catching those kids from really 1-2 months of life all the way up 2, 3, 4, 5 years of age in some of the school readiness areas that I know are targeted by the First Five. it's been a great program. I think the results speak for itself. It's cheap. There's very little, there's no administrative expense. The money is spent directly on the kids, including the aftercare should these kids need it. If they don't have access to care, we see them. We ensure that they get the care that they need, a lot of which is refractive care, glasses, things like that. But there's been some issues with some health issues, you know, blind eyes, other pathology that has been detected by some of these programs. It's a fantastic program. I really appreciate the support. I am thankful for the opportunity to present to all of you, and I hope that this program continues on. It's a great, great, great program. Thanks, thank Jason, you. And Susan, it was great working with you as well, Dr. Crocker. Thank but thank you.
Thanks, Mr.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Russell, Clinic Director of Tolosa Children's Dental in Paso Robles. Many of you are familiar with that Paso Robles site. We serve over 4,000 unique children a year up there. We're very fortunate in San Luis Obispo County to have a First Five that supports oral health because our children cannot be at their best and perform well in school if they have toothaches. Recently, our most current collaboration with First Five is we have opened a site in San Luis Obispo one day a week, and First Five is helping fund the preventive care appointments for 0 to 5. That is site's going incredibly well. We always knew the children were in Central County and South County. I guess what I had missed all the years I've been at Tolosa is the contact with parents who live in this part of the county who don't make it to Paso Robles. And on our first opening day, I had a mother standing in front of me full of joy and gratitude, crying because she could finally bring her child to Tolosa for a dental appointment because Paso Robles had proven too big of a barrier for her over the years, and she had missed multiple appointments with these children. And it's those events that tell us on a daily basis at Tolosa that we need to be there. And we need the support of organizations like First Five and other community to make sure that children can go to school on a daily basis and those and live and learn to read without toothaches. And I, on behalf of every child we see, on behalf of every staff member and board member of Partnership for the Children and Tolosa Dental, I just thank you for your continued and ongoing support.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Lou Gomez. I'm the school readiness site coordinator at Georgia Brown, and this is Alma Garcia, one of our parents, and also one of my heroes. We at Georgia Brown, we work, and Alma has been like the person that has utilized all the services that First Five has offered to us. She has three children. Two of her children went to the First Five school readiness. They're doing great at Georgia Brown and or at the middle school. She also, we had counseling. She has used the counseling to better serve her family. From there, she went on and she became a school site council member at Georgia Brown. She has been the president of the ELAC at Georgia Brown. Now she is a promotora in our community, and she's bringing the resources that she's learning and bringing it back to her community to help our families. So she couldn't be a greater hero for me than she makes me watering, my eyes watering, because this is the kind of person, this is the people, or this is what I, at the end of the day, think, okay, what have I done today? What have you as people that help us in the community, how have we helped our community? And like Susan said, it takes a village to raise a child, and thank you. It's been a great, just
thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Supervisor Gibson, that's our presentation.
All right.
Thank you very much for giving us the time to talk to you today. I also wanted to say thank you to the staff team at First Five. We are lean and mean. Jason Wells and Misty Livingood.
They're not that mean. But
you
guys,
they're we are lean and lovely. How about that?
Yeah. If you would introduce your...
Jason Wells and Misty Livingood. And when he went.
And if we might conclude, you're no stranger to the public life of San Luis Obispo County. In fact, interactions with the county over many years. Can you give us just a short sample? Because the whole thing would take Civil Service Commission. And Mr. Chapman, if you would take the lectern, it's my pleasure to read this resolution. It goes as follows. Whereas Arthur Chapman has served as a Civil Service Commissioner for San Luis Obispo County from September 24, 2003 through December 31, 2014, and whereas Art has served as Commission President since January of this year, and whereas the Commission wishes to recognize his many years of invaluable leadership and dedication, and whereas Art has consistently endeavored to make fair and reasonable decisions with regards to the matters presented to the Civil Service Commission, and has given generously of his time during his tenure as Commissioner in the interests of the employees and citizens of the County of San Luis Obispo. And whereas Art has demonstrated technical expertise, guidance, and consistent support for the Human Resources Department and its staff, and whereas Art has always been a kind, warm, and caring individual and will be greatly missed, and whereas Art can now freely engage full-time in his favorite hobby, which is bicycling, now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors recognizes that Arthur Chapman be and hereby is commended for his 11 years of dedication to the county mission. Be it also resolved that Art Chapman is wished the best of health, happiness, and good fortune in his continued service and beyond.
Sherry's here.
I was going to say tribute to Mrs. Chapman.
Oh, is she here?
Not here. We'll give you the last word, Art, but I just a couple of comments I'd like to make. First of all, it's my pride and pleasure to let the world know that Art has been the Second District's representative to the Civil Service Commission. And, again, one of these bodies that doesn't get as much public exposure as a lot of other things that the county does, and yet deals with hugely important issues of equity among the employees of this county organization, and it sometimes comes into areas which have no small share of controversy. And it has been a remarkable tenure that Art has served here, and as the resolution indicates, his thoughtfulness and calmness in the midst of some pretty seriously controversial subjects has been a wonderful asset, and we thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much. The lectern is yours, sir.
May I say something?
Absolutely. Well, I said it was your.
I appreciate the honor. It's been a pleasure to serve the commission. I have to thank your predecessor, former Supervisor Shirley Bianchi, for appointing me and for you to renew that appointment twice. I want to thank Dan Buckshy for supporting the HR department during this recent recession. I'll truly miss interacting with Tammy Douglas Schatz and the cadre of the dedicated professionals in the HR department. I also miss working with my fellow Civil Service Commission members. They each bring important expertise and a sense of justice and fairness to the job. I need to thank Rita Neal for assigning Tim McNulty as our commissioner. He's been a pleasure to work with, and he's kept us on the legal straight and narrow. And I want to truly offer my condolences to Tim for having drawn the short straw. There's no truth to the rumor that I'm leaving the commission because it's become boring. But in truth, we haven't adjudicated an appeal for nearly 2 years. I think that's significant for a couple of reasons. Not only has it saved the county a ton of money, but the lack of appeal activity shows progress in a number of areas. It starts with you, members of the board, and your foresight to continue to invest in the employee university during the recession and through now. This valuable program teaches departmental supervisors and managers how to treat employees with dignity and respect, to evaluate and properly document performance, and to prepare to take disciplinary action where it's warranted. It also gives them the confidence to carry it out when necessary, and that's important. Second, Susan Hossman, a county counsel, and Tammy Douglas-Schatz and her HR analyst are doing an excellent job advising managers and department heads to critically evaluate disciplinary actions before they're taken. As a result, both departments and those who represent employees have a better idea of their chances of success before the commission. Gives the parties an impetus to settle these issues when that is the best course of action. So what am I going to do with all my free time?
Right.
Well, since I've got the podium, I wanted to take a second to thank you on behalf of my fellow Cambrians for your support of our advanced water treatment system. We're on our way to water security after 30 years of failed attempts at this project. We still need your support. Regular development permit to make this plant permanent. The plant's a win-win for Cambrians and our farmer and rancher neighbors who also depend on the same creeks for their personal and agricultural water needs. So, again, thank you very much, and you may see me again.
Yeah. Thank you, Art.
That was what I was going to add. You can tell by the coda there that Art's not fading away. So we'll look forward to future visits. Our last resolution recognizes another legend of county service. And I've asked Supervisor Meacham to read a resolution recognizing the retirement of Ms. Cammie Griffin.
Hiding behind the podium. I thought you were off planning. Okay, it's my privilege to do this. This is the resolution for commending Cammie Griffith upon, this says, his retirement. Who wrote this? After 30 years of service with the Department of Planning and Building, Cammie graduated from Cal Poly in 1983 with a bachelor's in city and regional planning, was hired by the County Planning and Building Department in 1984, and never left. And whereas Cammie began her career as a planning technician and successfully progressed through the department's professional development services, or series, being promoted to assistant, associate, senior, and supervising planner, then to assistant director, and on two occasions served as the acting director. And whereas Cammie always made decisions based on sound planning principles and the highest ethical standards, providing expert counsel and guidance to staff, Cammie has truly made a difference in building a positive reputation for the department, and she will figuratively leave large shoes to fill, given her real feet are quite small. Whereas Cammie has provided strong leadership and goal-oriented management that promotes the wise use of land and that helps build great communities for present and future residents of San Luis Obispo County, whereas we wish Cammie all the best as she dances off into her next new adventure, and that her bright smile and contagious laugh, which I can always hear on the other side of my wall, will be thoroughly missed by all. Therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize 30 years of exemplary public service provided by Cammie Griffin to the residents of our county.
Yeah. Come over here for a picture too with your husband.
Yeah. we got that. We got that impression.
Okay.
Oh, look over here one time.
Oh, oh, now we're getting serious. Now
okay.
We're good. All right. Mr. Bergman?
All right. Almost, Cammie.
Yeah.
I'd love to say a few words on behalf of the department. As staff, we spent a lot of time fussing with words and numbers, trying to make them express the fullness and trueness of our intentions. So 5.5 is a big number today. However, the full measure of someone's value in the workplace, their, we'll call it the respect quotient, if you will, that quantitative measurement of gratitude, the repayment of good deeds completed over time, kindness given, mentorship, leadership, and the ever-present saving of bacon is really shown in actions and not in words. So Cammie's colleagues that are here today, people that have worked for the county now and in the past, is the true testament to Cammie's contributions to the department and the county organization. Cammie, it's apparent that your respect quotient is off the chart and is immeasurable. So on behalf of the department and the management team of the Planning and Building Department, it's my honor to say thank you for your 30-plus years of service to the department, and we wish you all the most exciting and fulfilling retirement for the future. Thank you, Cammie.
Well, I'm going to give you the last word, which is a little bit frightening given all you've seen over 30 years and how well you know various members of the county community. But we have start with Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cammie, I'm going to miss you in a lot of our
resolutions. And looking at your smile, which was referenced in the resolution, which is absolutely infectious, I think what strikes me is your fearlessness of wandering into whatever controversy, whatever decision, whatever hearing, whatever negotiation, whatever meeting needs to be taken, you're there. And you have stepped up on all of the big issues that have faced this county in terms of its land use and associated decisions over many, many years, long before I ever knew what a planning person really did. I thank you on behalf of this county and our communities, and you will be muchly missed. Mr. Meacham? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see her.
That's okay.
Cammie, Ms. Arnold.
That's all right. I just wanted to thank you as well. Your dedication to the county has just been amazing, and I've really enjoyed working with you over the years, so thank you.
I mean, I can't believe the number of times that I've asked for information, and over the weekend, Cammie will send me information on things, and it's one of the most difficult, I guess, departments to kind of navigate through is planning. There's so many different aspects of it, but you put it all together and you make it make sense of it, and you've been a tremendous help to me over the 6 years that I've been here. I wish you the best.
Well, and I would add to that, Cammie, that I don't believe you that it took her that long to get to you, because every time I asked her a question, she knew it right off the top of her head, and I asked some pretty technical questions. And I also just want to say thanks to your husband for giving us someone who gives everything of her time and everything to this job. And I'm sure she's amazing and can give more at home too, but you sacrificed her to us, and thank you for that, and thank you for being part of things for so long, Cammie.
You're here. Yeah. Madam.
Paavo told me to write my words down and read them. So hopefully it will keep the blubbering to a minimum, but I can't make any promises. So first off, thank you, members of the board, for the acknowledgement, and thank you to whoever had a hand in writing the resolution. It was really wonderful. It has been an amazing nearly 31 years. I have been so fortunate to have spent my career serving the public here in the county. This county is a very special place, and to have helped in any way to keep it such an amazing place has been an honor. Keeping this county special, though, doesn't happen without remarkable teamwork, not only from every department in the county, but also from our incredible communities, and they often go unsung. They have amazing volunteer efforts that they put into their community advisory councils and other grassroots organizations. We're fortunate to live in a place that not only government has a commitment to excellent excellence, but our communities are far from uninterested. my time in public service, although at times daunting, overall has been amazing and has provided me a positive perspective that will stay with me forever. There's a ton of people I would want to thank for their support, way too many to name, so I'm going to try and do this by groups. First off, the decision makers, the planning commissioners and board members who have to make the tough job of actually making decisions. County Council's office, who have kept us out of trouble for the most part. Human resources, who have helped us find and recruit the next generation of our public servants. The administrative office, whose excellent leadership, especially most recently, has guided us through some really tough economic times. And, of course, environmental health, public works, CAL FIRE, Ag Commissioner, APCD, and Parks, who are really our permit processing partners each day. And also to the private planning professionals. They're our colleagues on the other side of the counter. And I do need to mention a few individuals by name, and this is where I hope the blubbering doesn't start. I want to start with Paul Crawford. He hired me, and I have tried to emulate him in my job, and I miss him every day. Also, Pat Beck and Warren Hogue, who were wonderful mentors to me through the years, they provided me the opportunities to grow into what you see today. The management team, past and present, Ellen, Matt, Wes, Cheryl, Chris, Nancy, Trevor, and especially Irina, who is always there to support me. And the true unsung hero of our department, Chris Maychek. She keeps me in line, tells me what to do and where to go, and without whom I simply could not have done my job. And also each and every one of the past and present employees of the Department of Planning and Building. That will be truly the hardest part of retiring, is leaving the amazing staff of the department. They are amazing hard workers who do what it takes to get the job done. I'm looking forward to our next phase of life together. Although the planner stuff, it's probably still going to be there, so sorry. As many of you know, dragonflies are a very important symbol to me. And the dragonfly as a symbol usually symbolizes change, and typically a change in the perspective of self-realization. And so as I move on to my next phase of self-realization, I just wanted to say to all my friends in the county, please keep in touch. It's been my honor to work with you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to recess into the lobby for about 15 or 20 minutes to visit with Cammie and others that we have honored today, and we'll reconvene in probably about 20 minutes or so. We have all interested parties, so we will reconvene. And Madam Clerk, if you would introduce our afternoon item, please.
Item number 23, a hearing to consider an appeal by Kevin Elder on behalf of Edith Pluto and Cynthia Sugimoto of the Planning Commission's approval of a minor use permit, conditional development permit, and environmental impact report to allow for the construction of a 2,374-square-foot single-family residence within the residential single-family land use category on the west side of Studio Drive in the community of Cayucas. This hearing was continued from October 7, 2014, District 2.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Ms. Carroll.
Thank you, Ellen Carroll, Environmental Coordinator. Just a quick note, this is a continued hearing. We have a short staff presentation today. Ryan Hostetter is our project manager, and she will be making the presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
And as I indicated to someone just a minute ago, we will run this as an appeal hearing. So after staff presentation, questions from the board, we'll open it to the appellant for a 10-minute slot, then the applicant for a 10-minute slot, then any other members of the public who wish to comment. We'll come back with 5 minutes and 5 minutes and return to the board for deliberations. Ms. Hostetter.
Thank you, Ryan Hofstetter, planning staff. Before I dive into the presentation, in the past few days we've been receiving a lot of correspondence, and so I just want to make sure that your board also, I've been forwarding it to the clerk, and but I just want to point them out. I have copies for the public, or if you don't happen to have them, an email from Coastal Commission from yesterday, a letter from San Luis Obispo Coast Keeper, a letter from the applicant, Mr. Elder, the neighbor's attorney, dated, I have a package December 3rd, which he handed out to you, and then he handed out, I believe, yesterday a package to you, dated the 8th. So I have copies of those here for anybody who might need those. Just wanted to let you know. So, again, this is a continued hearing, and with my team here today, we have Shauna Scott across from me with SWCA, who worked on our EIR for this project, and Mike Phipps with Cotton Shires and Associates, our geologist on the project, who's here as well if to help answer any questions you may have. I'm just going to briefly refresh everybody's memory. The clerk said, like she said, this is a single-family home in the community of Cayucas on Studio Drive. Just a visual of what we looked at the last hearing. This was the project that the Planning Commission had approved, which is on appeal by the neighbor Sandy Sugimoto and Kevin Elder. This is an appeal hearing. We went through many appeal issues on the last hearing. We're not going to go through all of those again, but I'm going to touch on what the board direction was from that hearing, which asked for a continuance of the hearing. And your board asked to go back and explore project modifications, explore bluff setbacks based on communications we received from Coastal Commission, and potentially explore any modifications to the property boundaries. Since that hearing, we've continued to receive additional information from the neighbor geologists and consultants, and letters, like I pointed out this morning to you. The issues related to the bluff, what is the bluff and where is the bluff, continue to be debated. Since our last hearing, we had the opportunity to schedule a meeting to sit down with Coastal Commission staff. And Coastal Commission staff, Daniel, however, we don't have any additional information similar to what Coastal Commission requested, which included more modeling and 3D mapping of bedrock on the site. So we don't have that information. So since then, with that, staff is bringing forward four options for your board to consider on the project as far as taking an action on this application. One of those is, of course, you can deny the project, upholding the appeal. And if this were the case, the project would be finished at this level and would not be appealable to the Coastal Commission. An option number two in your staff report talks about continuing and asking the applicant to provide information regarding that 3D modeling and the additional modeling that Coastal Commission had requested. An option before you is continuing with the original staff recommendation from your June 3rd hearing, which is to deny the appeal and uphold the Planning Commission approved project, which was the larger, which was the 2,300 square foot house presented. That also includes a determination that the property does not contain the coastal bluff and the coastal bluff is located off the boundaries of the property. And another option that staff is bringing forward is option four, and this includes a line that staff has put together based on the photogrammetry in our aerial photography. This includes a 25-foot setback from that line. It includes revised conditions and revised findings, which are a part of your packet for the hearing today. and it includes conditions that require the style and small-scale neighborhood requirements from the Planning Commission approval would be carried forward. So it really allows for an envelope for a smaller home to be approved. And I'm going to go through that a little briefly. So when we initially investigated that, this is a compromise approach that we are calling. It is calling the edge of the rocks, the bluff area, or the area to measure this a 25-foot buffer from. And since we've put this together, we've received some correspondence from the applicant and the appellant showing where that line would be located. Ours was a rough calculation based on the plans, which would allow for an approximately 1,300 square foot house. But since we've published a staff report, we've had both the applicant and the appellant bring very similar diagrams showing where that line would be. And their interpretation of that line would be closer to the studio drive property, and it would allow for approximately a basement of the size of 600 square feet. In the upper level, it would really only allow the garage and potentially whatever they can fit with a mezzanine above the garage. So that would be using the line as submitted by those square footages is that line submitted by the neighbor and the applicant, which is this is the one from the applicant, and then this graphic, which is submitted by the appellant's information, is very similar. When we came up with our line, we used this historic aerial photograph to outline the boundary. And this is what our engineers are saying. This is potentially from the toe of the rock outcrop, based on the aerial photographs. And so we overlaid them on top of each other, and that's where this yellow line on the site. And that's what we use to measure the 25-foot compromise line. So I'm going to go back. This is the applicant's measurement. Again, this hatched area would be a potential. This would be the building envelope based on this line. So there are several options before you. Staff recommends option 3 or 4, 4 from the staff report, but option 3 also allows a project approval, which would allow opportunity to appeal a project. Just Mark Johnson, this is not considering these new graphics that we got today, mm-hmm. but basically the discussion is that the site contains coastal process activity, therefore it meets the definition because of seawater essentially being able to hit the site. However, it goes on, the last few sentences of that also says that the bluff is off of the site, outside the project boundaries, and this could be the face within this area. So that's the last paragraph. It says, thus it appears that the entire parcel is seaward of the bluff edge, whether the bluff is coastal or fluvial. So that information leads us to believe that it's that the bluff may be the line, the top of bluff, could be off of the site.
Landward,
excuse me.
A couple more, if I could. Sure. If we were to select an option that sent this forward to Coastal, I guess it's likely that Coastal will require the kind of technical and modeling, the technical information modeling that we talked about the last time?
Yes, it's very likely. They've let the applicant know that, or us know, and we let the applicant know that's what they would be looking for.
Okay. And finally, the fourth option, the one that, you know, staff, based on the information drew, we're looking at a building envelope of, it's pretty small, unless I was getting it right, because it seemed that when you said that, when you looked at both the applicant and the appellant's view of the line, you're really looking at maybe a three-story thing, basement, parking, and a mezzanine of, what, 600 feet maximum square feet in terms of a living space?
I did a rough calculation of the plans in a basement of 600, the garage, and then a mezzanine that they could fit above the garage based on all the setbacks, a couple hundred square feet.
Would that would qualify in terms? I mean, it seems even too small for our own standards, no?
No, it's not too small to be considered a dwelling unit.
Okay. That's it for now. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Ray?
Third question was my question.
Okay. Ms. Arnold?
My quick question, sorry, I should know the answer to this, but all of the options are appealable to the Coastal Commission. Correct, not correct.
Only so the option that includes denying the project that, was
of
not
course
correct.
Not but
the others are.
So the new option number 4 is appealable.
Yes, it is. Continuing the project as well is an option, and that's not appealable. So it's options 3 or 4 are appealable.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Let me ask one question. At this point, the applicants have not considered any boundary changes to the parcel. That was part of board direction from the last time.
That's correct. We discussed it with the applicant, and knowing that the properties surrounding this property are publicly owned, the what it would take to do that seemed beyond what their scope at this time.
Okay. And they've refused to the technical investigation that the Coastal Commission has requested, and I'll let them speak to that as well.
Yeah, I'll let them speak to that. They continued with the photogrammetry information rather than the 3D modeling.
Okay. And they have not at this point asked for a variance
That's right.
On this project. What could be modified if a variance were granted? Not to say that what amount, but what sorts of things could be addressed in a variance proceeding?
Setbacks, parking, those are major things that would add square footage that could be done with a variance, assuming one could be approved and the findings could be met. Things such as even height requirements, design, things that would modify the square footage.
So, for instance, this house requires by standard a parking space and at least a one-car garage, and that standard could be waived to have simply two parking spaces at some point. And what was my other question about variances? One of the key elements is uniqueness of situation, as I remember, the findings necessary for variance. And I think as we get into the discussion, there is no more unique piece of property, a lot of legal record in this county that I can imagine at this point. So with that, Mr. McMasters, anything to add on that matter?
I just wanted to add one thing, and that is that in our discussions with the Coastal Commission, they also they raised a question as to whether or not they could even not just support a variance, but they did not know if a variance would even be possible for their property.
Well, so. And of course, the other finding of one of the other five findings of a variance is that failure to grant the variance would deny the applicant reasonable use of the property. So, I mean, there's a rich vein of discussion there, but that's not
location of where the setbacks apply in Exhibit B of Conditions of Approval, Paragraph 1C, and Attachment 4 called Proposed Bluff Line is inconsistent with the staff report description of Option 4 and Exhibit A Findings, Paragraph 1. It is recommended that these inconsistencies be resolved and corrected to avoid any confusions on the Board of Supervisors' intent. It must be clear that the county's proposed setback is intended to be applied from the toe of the bluff or the top edge of the bluff. There should be no confusion over this issue. There is a significant distance, approximately 25 to 35 feet, between the toe of the bluff and the top of the bluff that should not be ignored. Additionally, per the following policies, the coastal bluff setback should be measured from the top of the bluff and not the toe of the bluff. Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance Section 23.04.118 states that new development shall be set back from the bluff edge, a distance sufficient to withstand bluff erosion and wave action for a period of 75 years. The Estero Area Plan Section 5-F.1 states that bluff setbacks shall be in accordance with the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, except that the minimum setback shall be 25 feet in any case. Table 7-1 states that modification requirements. The project should be set back a minimum of 25 feet from the bluff top and further when necessary to withstand 100 years of erosion. In addition, there are examples of the Estero Area Plan Section 3 where it talks about bluff setbacks and states that the bluff setback shall be sufficient to withstand bluff erosion and wave action for a period of 100 years and in no case shall be less than 25. The project is also inconsistent with Policy S-23 of the safety element of the County General Plan. It states that the development shall not be permitted near the top of eroding coastal bluff. We recommend that Attachment 2 of the revised CEQA findings, Section F, Geology and Soils, Item 6, be modified. It does not seem to be adequately updated to reflect the recommended option number 4 or the variances the county proposed to take regarding the setback that are being required. And now I'll ask Mark Fox to provide his update.
Go back one slide, please. Good afternoon, Board. Our firm submitted a letter to you on December 2nd with our review comments on the Shoreline Engineering Bluff Study. We disagree with a portion of the Shoreline Engineering Study and believe, like the Coastal Commission does in the memo they submitted yesterday, that based on the study's profiles, cross-sections, and associated photographs, that the project is on a coastal bluff and located below the top edge of the bluff on the bluff face. Development on a bluff face is in violation of County Coastal Plan Policy 11 regarding development on a coastal bluff. Policy 11 limits the new development on bluff faces to public access stairways and shoreline protection structures. Therefore, the project is in violation of the local coastal program, a portion of the land use element of the San Luis Obispo County General Plan. Next slide, please. Our letter, dated December 8, 2014, comments on the staff report and the proposed findings and resolution. We had recommended that figures using applicant's drawing A1.1 be used to replace staff report attachment 4. Ryan went over that earlier this morning, where the applicant had also put a setback on drawing A1.1. Our drawing is very similar to the applicant's drawing. This kind of topographic survey drawing is more accurate and easier to verify than the attachment 4 photographic sketch. Our letter provided as figure 1 shows a purple line indicating the edge of the rocks in the ice plant and an orange line representing the 25-foot setback. The light blue line indicates the top of the bluff as shown in the Shoreline Engineering Study. We recommend either using this figure 1 or a similar figure based on setback from the top of the bluff so the diagram is consistent with the Board of Supervisors' intent in the resolution. Next slide, please. Staff report, next slide, please. Staff report attachment 2, the revised CEQA findings, the wave run-up hazard section, supplemental analysis, reports maximum wave run-up to an elevation of 20.
Kevin Elder. Good afternoon, Supervisors. Kevin Elder representing the appellant as well. Slide 7, please. Just a couple more notes about the recommendations in the staff report. The recommendation ignores the northern portion of the bluff, which it considers to be a fluvial bluff. projects located on the Old Creek Coastal Stream Bluff must be set back a minimum of 50 feet in accordance with Estero Area Plan, Cayuga Section, Sensitive Resource Area Table 7-2. The lack of a riparian setback will establish a precedent for other properties adjacent to creeks countywide. Slide 8, please. With respect to the project changes and the project descriptions, we believe that the circumstances in the project description have changed, which affect the EIR. The EIR analyzed the site as a non-coastal bluff property. County staff now agrees that the site includes a coastal bluff. Therefore, the EIR should be amended to analyze the site as a coastal bluff and make the EIR consistent with the project site determination. Also, staff's recommendation allows a new project to be designed and submitted with construction permit plans. Therefore, there would be no public review or hearing of the proposed revised plans, and this is generally not acceptable given the significant revisions to the current plans. Also, there was mention earlier of slide 9, please, of the failure to investigate or try to take advantage of the county right-of-way and what that might offer in terms of a larger building envelope. So our recommendation is that the board reverse the commission's decision and uphold the appeal and deny the project as designed. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Elder. Seeing no questions of the appellant, we'll offer the 10 minutes to the applicant.
Good afternoon, Chair Gibson and members of the board. My name is Kathy Novak from Novak Consulting. I believe the remaining issue and the focus of all the attention now is making the determination if this residence is to be built on a coastal bluff or not. Before a decision can be rendered as to whether this is a coastal or fluvial bluff, justifiable parameters must be set for the evaluation of this issue. So today I'm going to be covering the following things. One, the current versus the historic topographic conditions. Two, definitions for coastal bluffs and consistent use of codes and policies. And three, the project options. To begin, the county and the Coastal Commission has and will review this project based upon pre-development conditions. We originally thought that the artificial fills placed on this property was the result of the construction of Highway 1 and Studio Drive. However, after reviewing the Caltrans archival images from 1953, it has become abundantly clear that these fills were placed on the site after 1965 and without the owner's permission. County staff has noted in prior reports and in the EIR that it is inappropriate to consider that the man-made features such as the artificial fill prisms graded for roadway developments comprise bluffs. Therefore, the determination for the terminus of the coastal bluff should be based on natural and historic features. Next slide, please. Oh, excuse me, Ryan, back one up. Sorry. Okay, thank you. This graphic shows the 1953 topographic contour line fairly consistent with the artificial fills identified in the geotechnical boring reports, as well as the 2014 line after the artificial fill was placed. On a side note, it's interesting to see that there is more of a sandy beach now than there was in 1953. Therefore, the first part in making the determination for a coastal bluff line should be based on historic conditions with natural features and not present-day artificial conditions. My next subject is definitions. There are several documents that can be used for guidance in defining a coastal bluff. I have provided you with copies of these, so I only highlight a couple of them. Next slide, please. The Estero Area Plan states, quote, coastal bluff, a steep bank or cliff generally having a relief of 10 feet or more, and the toe of the bluff may be subject to marine erosion. Next slide, please. California Code of Regulations Section 13577 describes the termini of the bluff line or the edge based upon the general trends of the seaward and inland facing bluff lines. This particular definition has also been used repeatedly to determine the termini of the coastal bluffs and is addressed in the EIR. As noted in your staff report, Mr. Phipps concludes that the shoreline engineering report dated September 28th generally supports the analysis found in the technical report prepared for the EIR, which locates the termini of the coastal bluff near the southern boundary of the Loparina property. Next slide, please. The Coastal Commission draft sea level rise policy guidance states in part, quote, for purposes of the statewide interpretive guidelines, cliff or bluff is limited to those features having a vertical relief of 10 feet or more and sea cliff is a cliff whose toe is or may be subject to marine erosion. This definition has a second part that states, quote, and sea cliff is a cliff whose toe is or may be subject to marine erosion, end quote. The Commission has furthermore used these policies in the analysis of other projects and determined that the projects are consistent with the Coastal Act with the inclusion of these policies. And then my next subject is the project options. Your staff report includes four options for your consideration. We believe that option three, to deny the appeal and move the project forward as presented and approved by the Planning Commission, is the only feasible option. Next slide, please. Yes, thank you. Option number four is to modify the project by determining that there's a coastal bluff on the western side of the property, which in turn requires a 25-foot setback from the edge of the coastal bluff. Included with your report is attachment number four that shows a proposed bluff and 25-foot buffer line that corresponds to this option. I must respectfully disagree that this exhibit is an appropriate depiction of the coastal bluff location. I also do not believe that it is a provides consistency with the application of county policies, factual information specifically enough for you to adopt the findings and conditions of approval contained in the board resolution and the revised CEQA findings that support this modified project for numerous reasons. First, I'd like to question, how was the 2011 line created and does it follow any particular contour? Excuse me. Again, there is no justification or explanation as to how this line was drawn other than it seems to follow the vegetation line. Second, the 2011 line simply states bluff. However, there is no indication as to whether this is the top of the bluff or the toe of the bluff. Number three, if there is a top of the bluff, then the toe must be drawn on the exhibit. The location of the toe of the bluff is extremely important. First, the findings state that the lateral access should be from the toe of the rock outcrop and the conditions of approval to require the toe of the bluff. If the rock outcrop is the toe of the bluff, which it appears to be based on the findings and the conditions, then where is the top of the bluff? If the toe and the top of the bluff are in the same location, then there is no bluff. If the top of the bluff changes inland from the proposed location, it will only exacerbate the already reduced buildable area for this lot. The buildable area for this house, as proposed in your staff report, has been reduced to a point that is infeasible to construct a single-family home that meets the California Building Code and other county requirements. This exhibit shows the remaining area of the entire house in green and the garage in orange and a parking space in blue. The green area represents approximately 200 square feet. On the western side of the house, it is only 6 feet wide at the outer dimensions. So for understanding, the wall widths are at 1 foot, the corridors are at 3 feet, which leaves 2 feet wide for spaces for other uses. However, and importantly, building code requires 7 feet for a habitable space. So therefore, this design, you are essentially left with a space that is large enough for a restroom and a closet. In conclusion, the county staff in previous reports and the EIR and our project teams prior testimony has presented you with sound and defensible evidence that this property is not a coastal bluff. Please also keep in mind that the California Coastal Commission has readily admitted to staff that there has been inconsistent determinations made in other areas of the state in regards to wave run-up, so this calls into question the comments that have been received in interpretations of other policies, including the coastal bluff. Last, adopting a bluff line as shown on attachment number four is arbitrary and capricious and is not based on any laws, ordinances, or standards. This hybrid project is also not justified based on any technical expert review, environmental determinations, or factual basis, and therefore should not be considered. I would respectfully ask that you avoid the mix-and-match philosophy with the policies and the interpretations to obtain a particular and desired outcome which appears to kill this project. It is clear that approving anything less than the project as presented in option number three will deny reasonable economic use of the property and will also deny the applicant reasonable use of the property as it relates to prior approvals for other homes in the similar size in the surrounding area. On behalf of the local arenas, I would sincerely ask for your support for option number three. The project engineer and Mr. Alan Volbrecht, a land surveyor that has worked with us, is also available to answer any technical questions that you may have. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Novak. Mr. Meacham, a question for Ms. Novak?
Ms. Novak, if I could, please. Thank you. Do you have any idea when the infill took place?
It was after 1965.
That's a long time ago.
Yes.
Anything more specific than that?
And if
I guess what I'm trying to make a determination is, was there construction done next to this site that put the infill on this building?
Mr. Elser, if you're going to testify, you can come to the lectern. give us your name for the record, please.
I'll let him answer.
Bruce Elster. The only records that we've been able to find so far from the Caltrans archives are 1965. When you correlate the 1953 plan...
Concerns regarding the proposed project. One is that it's not set back off of the sand line far enough. This is an area that I have seen flooded before when there were heavy rains in our county. It should be taken into consideration that the toe of the bluff is constantly changing. Plants that were shown in the aerial photograph just from a few months ago or earlier this year that were taken, they're gone now, and we haven't even had a large or very strong storm come in. So it's just proof that this area is constantly changing with the tidal action and the waves. During the Planning Commission meeting last January, Commissioner Myers stated that this lot should never have been parceled as buildable. I agree. He stated that it is an irregular lot for the area. The house would actually be built on the face of the bluff and not the top of the bluff, as that's actually the road up there. I don't believe the variances and exceptions to the existing regulations should be allowed for this one house. There are many concerns as to the safety of building below the bluff tops there. I believe they should be required to follow the same setbacks that all the other homes along this stretch of land have had to follow. I've read about the, this is another point is I've read about the construction to be done around the cypress tree, and there's also a removal of a pine tree there. Because of the way the roots of the cypress tree are growing into the hillside, it will not be healthy for the tree and will weaken and most likely kill it if they're disturbed. Coastal trees need to be preserved for the wildlife that depends on them for survival at this point, as we are losing so many trees to the drought. I believe it'd be very irresponsible to issue a permit to build a home like this on this lot, and I respectfully urge the board to deny the permit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herman. Mr. Hensley, you'd submitted a request to speak.
Good morning, or afternoon, I mean. I escaped jury duty. Gordon Hensley, San Luis Obispo Coast Keeper. We submitted a letter asking that you would support the appeal and oppose the certification of the EIR. I think you've heard plenty about the bluff top and whether it's a bluff or whether it's not, and clearly the applicant has an argument with the Coastal Commission. I think the question for you all today is whether the county has any argument with the Coastal Commission about their opinion, which seems pretty firm. It appears to us that the no project alternative is the most consistent with the county certified LCP, and we would urge that you would go there. This is not the only opportunity for this property owner. They can come back with other proposals that would be more consistent. In addition, we have some confusion about whether the stormwater scheme that is outlined in the project is actually consistent with the county's stormwater permit, and there's some confusion in the findings that are before you that we brought to your attention. In particular, in attachment 2, page 24 of 47 of your staff report. It says that no new stormwater drainage facilities or expansion of facilities would be required, and therefore that there's some response of staff about the permit based on that. However, in the revised findings that have been provided under the water handling and mitigation, it says this: the project includes removal of the existing county storm drain and construction of a new stormwater management system, including an inlet with a filter, an outlet, and energy dissipators. That's a pretty major sort of remodel and kind of contradicts the fact that no new storm drainage facilities will be in place. These internal confusions, I think, need to be cleared up before you sign off on the findings that you have before you. Again, we are asking that you would support the appeal and not certify the EIR. Thank you.
And hang on.
Mr. Hensley, I think we can get a bailiff to take you back if you've escaped.
Well, I didn't. I escaped the opportunity.
Thanks.
I didn't walk out on them.
My question is whether justice was served.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. That was my last request to speak, so we'll close it to the general public and come back for closing remarks. You want to ask a question of staff first before we have closing remarks? Let's do it. Go ahead. Once you question staff.
Well, first of all, maybe staff could comment on what was just brought up about the stormwater.
Yes, Shauna.
That includes installation of Whale Rock Reservoir and includes construction and rerouting of the highway, which was very significant in this area and included a lot of grading. So those things significantly altered the landform in this area. In addition to that, with the creek being modified through Whale Rock installation, the drainage patterns, this little area in here all was impacted from the creek. And since that's been dammed up, that activity, it just hasn't been the same since. One thing our project geologist also brought up, which is prevalent of people in Oceano area are very familiar, is windblown sand. It's a common issue. And so potentially also the dune activity has changed over time because of wind. And so all of those things over time alter the landform. So that's okay. What would look different.
Thank you. And then can you go to your one of your modified sketches of where that option four, I know that you said both the applicant and the appellant had similar drawings, but our drawing was a little different. Can you go to one of the ones that seemed to agree? And then I have a question about it.
This one here shows, let me go. This was submitted by, it's a little bit easier to read. I feel like there's less on here. I can show both. This one's a little bigger.
I'm going to guess that that's a typo, about 20 square feet, or is that, where does that come from?
You know, I think the applicant who put this together is going to have to speak to where they were coming up with that number.
Okay, and maybe it's the arm from theirs, I don't know, but maybe we can ask them when they come up. But my question, too, is with the pink hashed area there, It appears that there's no discussion here about a second story. Are height requirements such that a second story is not available to them?
A second story is available, and they're limited to an elevation based on the elevation of the center of Studio Drive, which is a bit higher than this site. So their height requirement is 15 feet from the elevation of Studio Drive. If I remember, I can go back to the plan, but that's approximately at elevation 42 feet, I believe. And they can clarify me if I'm remembering incorrectly. But
so when you said a mezzanine, that would be talking about over the carport portion of that. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the original design was a tri-level. So it included a basement and then the main level with the garage and then the mezzanine or the third level up above. And we think that you know, that potentially could remain in this area.
So in terms of a building envelope, we're talking about if the numbers on there are correct, you have essentially an envelope of about 450 square feet, but that would double and or triple depending on whether or not you could go two or three stories?
Not likely that much because the upper floor has to be smaller than the lower floor to comply with a small-scale neighborhood. The condition it talks about of the small-scale neighborhood standards, and what that means is the upper floor has to be set back an additional 2 feet, 2.5 feet from the lower floor wall, so it gives that what we call wedding cake look to the design. So it requires a smaller upper level. So they don't get entirely that square footage. But
what would you estimate, if this were the option that the board chose, what would you estimate the buildable area to be with the inclusion of, I'm sorry, the square footage to be of living space?
So if I went on their plans and I were to, that line, let me go back to theirs and I'll... So there, the line is really close to the stairwell. So I was using that as a monument. It cuts the stairwell and cuts a corner off. So if I were to really just count, this is our original plan. This is the lowest level of basement. They would get kind of what's inland of the stairwell here, which is, what was it, approximately 600 square feet, maybe slightly less because this corner is cut off. For the basement, and if we go up from there, let's see, that's the mezzanine. I'm going to zoom in here. This line and these calculations aren't what I want to show you here. Okay, so this is the level above. Make this a little bit bigger. Here's a stairwell again. So the main level, really what you're left with in here on this level is just that garage area and the carport. And then the upper level, the mezzanine, here's the stairwell. Most of the mezzanine was on the other side of the stairwell. They would be limited to an area here and potentially maybe even popping out a little bit over a design with Coastal that they wouldn't actually take on an appeal. So that's happened before. But there is opportunity for amendment.
But if it's under appeal, they go de novo on that, don't they, Council?
That's correct. I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. So the first thing the Coastal Commission would do would be to determine whether or not there's a substantial coastal issue, and if they did, they would review the project de novo.
Can you explain what that means to me?
It means that it wouldn't matter what decision was made below, whether it was approved or under what the conditions were, that they would set out to apply the coastal policies of the county to that project themselves.
And so a revision would happen at Coastal Commission rather than dropping back down here?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Clean slate. Ms. Arnold.
So I just had a couple questions of you, Ryan, I think. And first of all, couldn't get more confusing. Still. The first question I had was, so the county does not recognize the fill that we're all kind of discussing as part of the bluff.
That's right.
Okay. Then my next question is the county, am I getting this right, that the county considers the pre-development conditions when determining the presence of a coastal bluff?
That's right.
Then my next question is, I was getting kind of mixed signals here, so I'm just asking you for... I thought I heard you say that the Coastal Commission, in their letter, if I'm quoting it right, that the bluff is outside the project boundaries, that came from Coastal Commission.
Correct.
I'm seeing that in the shoreline engineering, we got so much of this kind of since the shoreline engineering letter, they're saying that Cotton and Shires found the coastal bluff terminated to the south of the project.
That's right.
But then the appellant in their correspondence and in their slideshow are talking about the project is on a coastal bluff. I mean, that was presented in the slideshow. So am I crazy or are we having conflict here still?
We have conflict, yes.
Okay. then I'll move away from the... So the coastal bluff, we're still seeing conflict between just about everybody. Okay.
Right.
The appellant also said... Seawalls are prohibited, and they explained it, but that staff recommended the project, including the seawall. So there must be conflict there.
Disagreement, not conflict.
Okay. Okay. That's what we're doing. We've got conflict in our words. The staff is agreeing that a seawall is allowable, and the appellant is, we're seeing in their presentation, it's prohibited. So... Is that just another agree to disagree, kind of, that it's not been resolved?
We have an additional disagreement. You're correct. However, we are not recognizing that the basement is a seawall. With the project that was approved by the Planning Commission, okay, we determined that the basement of the house was not a seawall.
Okay. And I remember that discussion back in the other. Okay, those are all my questions. Okay. Thank you.
With that, let me go to closing comments by first the applicant and then the appellant. 5 minutes if you need it.
Kathy Novak from Novak Consulting again. It appears the issue has boiled down to the location of the bluff line, and you have three diverse opinions regarding this. Our stated position is that the property is not located on a coastal bluff, therefore the bluff setbacks do not apply. The appellant argues that this is a coastal bluff and that the bluff line is inward of the location identified by staff. Staff has drawn a bluff line along the edge of the vegetation line and describes the toe of the bluff. This option includes a 25-foot setback. We believe that you have been provided with sufficient technical information that has also been reviewed by your EIR consultants, and the conclusion is that this property is not on a coastal bluff and is not subject to any coastal bluff setbacks. The appellant's evaluation and comments are careful to use the generic term bluff without the distinction as to whether the bluff being discussed is either fluvial or coastal. As a result, the conclusion and identification of the bluff line is misleading and inaccurate. The staff opinion to locate the bluff line along the vegetated edge is purely arbitrary. This method creates considerable confusion and redefines state law. We have shown you an accurate portrayal of the staff proposed bluff line with a 25-foot setback, which results in approximately 200 square feet area for the house and 430 square feet area for the garage and parking space. The staff interpretation for the measurement of the 25-foot setback line results in a complete different conclusion with an approximate 1,400 square foot area that includes the house, the garage, and the parking space. And I know the staff has corrected some of this afternoon. We've also provided you this updated slide interpretation of the actual location of the bluff top, and a clear and concise way to measure a 25-foot setback is not justified or appropriate for the statutory requirements for the findings of approval. This is a classic case of taking haphazard information at a late date, superseding years of difficult and extensive work, and creating a new project that is problematic and open-ended. In conclusion, we believe that the only project that can be approved today is option number 3. If the board feels it is necessary to redesign this project to conform to the bluff setbacks in order to approve this project, I would respectfully ask that you send this concept back to staff for further refinement and to identify the top of the bluff and its related impacts. A proper environmental review and analysis should be performed by your technical experts based on adopted county codes and policies and complete information on the top of the bluff and the identification. This new information should be published and provide adequate time for public review and comment. Therefore, this project should be continued to allow for this review, and anything short of this is a taking in this land away from the local arenas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Novak. With that, then, closing comments from the appellant.
Thank you. Just a few quick comments. We disagree with the applicant's statement that no significant erosion hazard exists at the site for the next 100 years. Staff Attachment 4 shows the bluff line in 2011, approximately 60 feet inland of what they label the 1957 bluff line. I think they meant a 1953 bluff line. But nevertheless, it's 60 feet in about 60 years of recession of the bluff. Ryan, could we have the slide that shows the figure 1, our drawing based on drawing A1.1? That shows... That's the applicant's. There, that one. This is figure 1 where we drew a 25-foot setback from the edge of the rocks in the ice plant as mapped by the applicant. The Before I go to that, I want to say whether there's a discussion of the fills that were placed and whether they were placed as part of the adjacent Highway 1 construction about 1963 or privately after 1965. That makes no difference. The fill that was placed is still fill. It's subject to coastal erosion, especially with increasing sea level, which will cause more frequent, forceful wave impact in the future. The Coastal Commission, in what they sent staff yesterday, states the entire parcel is seaward of the top edge of the bluff. The top edge of the bluff, as it was located by the applicant by their 1953 topographic mapping, is showing on the drawing in front of you as a blue line. That blue line shows that virtually the entire parcel is seaward of the top edge of the bluff. We believe that a home is still not allowed on the bluff face. We went over one of the visual and scenic resource policies that limits development to public access facilities and shoreline protection structures as the only things allowed on the bluff face. It's not uncommon for a property to be completely unbuildable. There's lots of parcels that meet that definition because of various environmental or regulatory constraints. This may be one of them. Although we drew figure one showing a 25-foot setback landward from the edge of the rocks and vegetation as mapped by the applicant, we do not agree that setback, building landward of it, complies with San Luis Obispo County regulations. That's for your department and your board to decide. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox.
Kevin Elder, just to conclude very quickly and to address Supervisor Arnold's question, I think there is dispute about whether it's a coastal bluff, but I think Coastal Commission agrees it's a bluff. I think county staff's consultants agree it's a bluff. We do, and I think it's just the applicant still who's debating that. But I think otherwise everyone agrees there's a coastal bluff there. We can talk about where it is, the toe or the top, but I think it's definitely affected by a coastal bluff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elder. And with that, I will close it to public comment and bring it back to the board for deliberation. Mr. McMasters, you drew your microphone close. What you got?
Yes, Steve McMasters, County Planning. I just want to clarify where option four came from, and that is staff nor our consultants really necessarily agree that it is a coastal bluff, direct to the contrary of what Mr. Elder just said. We prepared offices at the county, as we've discussed. I don't think we've encountered a lot like this where we've been dealing with this. So I just wanted to be clear that option four was to try to present options for the board to make a decision or to request additional information, but it does not necessarily reflect that county staff agrees that that is a coastal bluff, or if where the location of the coastal bluff is. I think we still would rely on the information that is in the EIR and prepared by our consultant.
Disclaimer noted. Thank you, Mr. McMaster. Mrs. Arnold, do you have a
question? A couple questions, and thank you for all that. And the appellant just stated again that the Coastal Commission agreed there's a coastal bluff.
Yes.
But going back to the reading that Ryan gave us earlier, that the Coastal Commission said the bluff was outside the project boundaries. So they were referring to the project that the Planning Commission approved when they made that statement?
They were referring to the top of the bluff, and that the top of the bluff is located just landward of the property boundary. So that would render this Loperina parcel being the face of the bluff, potentially.
Okay. So I was misinterpreting that statement then, that they were not, the Coastal Commission is not saying, when I thought I got it down just as you read it, that the bluff was outside project, the bluff, what they see as a bluff or part of the bluff was outside these project boundaries. That's the way I was interpreting it. That's not right.
When we measure a bluff setback, we measure it from the top of the bluff. And the top of the bluff is not located, according to that, it's not located on the applicant's property.
So then it becomes all about the setback and what's required. Is that I'm sorry.
And whether how to measure whether the bluff is measured from what the Coastal Commission said is the top of the bluff, which is not on the property, or if it's something else on the face of the bluff. It's where to measure that 25 feet from.
Okay.
And Coastal Commission has said that the bluff is not on their property.
I have to say that I agree with Mr. Masters that the dialogue needs to happen with the Coastal Commission at any, no matter what happens here today. It sounds like that discussion is ongoing here as well as there, and it'll happen in both places. And if we were to deny the appeal and approve the Planning Commission's recommendation, then that discussion would move to the Coastal Commission, correct? Is that a way to make that happen?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
That's exactly the question that I was going to ask. If we approve option three, let the Coastal Commission figure this thing out, and rather than have us keep debating this back and forth. I think there's a couple of issues here. As far as talking about the fill, that doesn't make any difference. It would make a difference to me if I knew that my neighbor pushed the fill on my property. I'd have a little problem with that. Secondly, we haven't come to conclusion about where these lines are. We've got several different boundaries that we're looking at here. And I think fundamentally there are some that really believe about the bluff and believe about the wave action, but I believe there's some that just don't want to see a house built there. So I think if we just take this to let them go to the Coastal Commission and let them hash through it.
Ms. Ray?
Well, it sounds like the direction here is, or the direction of discussion anyway, is around options three or four. And I'm inclined towards option number four because really the interpretation is honestly going to end up at Coastal Commission regardless. So I would be more inclined to take a more conservative approach based on what we anticipate is going to happen at Coastal anyway, since we have a pretty good direction of that. If we take option three, then we're ignoring that. So I would be inclined to go to option four, and if for whatever reason staff's interpretation does not prevail, they get that, what did you call it, de novo opportunity at that point to expand potentially what that project would look like. So I think it would be, I don't find a way to get to option number three and just ignore what the information that we have from the Coastal Commission.
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, I would agree, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just as staff, Mr. McMaster, has laid it out, you know, it's kind of irksome to continually get this information from Coastal. You know, we get this information from the people, and then Coastal sends a letter just the last minute. And it's almost as if they're saying, we know there's a feud here. This might end up with a lawsuit. You guys should take care of it because we don't want to, but we're going to, you know, basically tell you without further getting into why Coastal Commission can be rather irksome in this manner. I think the best thing to do is go with four, which I agree with my colleague, with send it to Coastal and let them hash this out and let the applicants try to. I got to say that
I'm not inclined to make that decision here because I don't think all the options have been. Have been explored. Given the extraordinary uniqueness of this parcel, I think the applicants have to understand that a big or even an average-sized dwelling is not necessarily guaranteed here. There are huge constraints, important issues of coastal policy that need to be rectified or resolved, reconciled. It might be the right word. If you could put your first elevation up, I'm just gonna give a little bit of commentary that why I think option four is as good as it's going to get. You see the proposed residence there, and if you look down at the base on seaward side at the downcoast side of the property, up against the blue house to the right, you'll see the outcropping of a piece of rock that is in fact the same material that's basically the same as what is undisputedly coastal bluff further down coast from there. That is listed in the EIR, and I remember very distinctly in the EIR that it indicates that the ocean has impinged on that particular outcrop. And so my conclusion is that at least at that point on the Loparina property there exists a coastal bluff. The technical information that we have been presented is far from definitive, and I share Supervisor Hill's struggle with trying to make clarity of it. There's been a lot of technical analysis of cross sections and old photographs, but again, there's the argument has swung both ways on the same set of data, and it was compounded to me when it was made clear that the documentation of the fill is not definitive, and I think that was by the application by the testimony of one of the applicant's agents. The appellant's concerns, straight up, if taken, would make this lot unbuildable. In particular, they are asserting that the house has to be located above the 25 or 26 foot contour. There's only a tiny sliver of land that is such on that parcel, and so I don't think that's reasonable. The proposed project, to me, is quite clearly inconsistent with the LCP, our local coastal program. And so, whereas we are going to pass this on and know with as close to complete certainty as possible that it's going to be figured out at the Coastal Commission, I'm not willing to abdicate completely our responsibility to make a reasoned decision on the matter of how we condition this property. I think staff, in particular Ms. Hostetter and her people, as I've come to call them, did as good and reasonable a job as possible. They established a coastal bluff. They established a setback from what appears quite clearly be coastal bluff, and they made a reasonable attempt to project that setback across the property. We can argue one way or another whether that's right or not, but I think there is a dwelling unit. According to our staff, there is a dwelling unit that it can be constructed to code. And so I guess the only other option is whether the appellant would like to have this continued under the direction of option four to seek a variance to make a little bit more of a house on that. But having no request to do so, it seems to me to be the most reasonable thing, not the only reasonable thing. I think the most reasonable thing is to move forward and approve this project under option four.
Yeah. I would call for the question.
Okay, and Supervisor Arnold did.
I just really quick wanted to just give my reason for sticking with option number three, and that is just that I never saw in all the discussion today a definitive reason to not accept the project is approved by the Planning Commission, or to overturn the Planning Commission's that body's decision. But I think generally we're all in agreement that it really does need to go for. It's further and last discussion right. to the Coastal Commission.
Council, you have light on. Is there anything you'd like to advise us?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to speak to the motion. We have a package which is a proposed resolution, an Exhibit A findings, and a revised Exhibit B conditions of approval, which I believe carries out the motion. The resolution has been signed by Whitney McDonald of our office and dated December 9th, 2014. I hope the board members all have this.
That was
this
in the staff report and presented to
the findings are A through L, and the conditions of approval are 1 through 47.
Okay. And does the clerk have that documentation?
Is it what was presented in the staff report?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So,
fourth. This is a reso. I can bring it up on the screen a little
please.
Bit better here. This one. We're looking at it. So findings, it goes through L. The one in your packet goes through K. So L includes a finding regarding the sea level rise information.
Okay. Which is not.
Wait, let's see. That was K. So. Oh, I'm sorry. We added, F. Let's see.
So added F and renumbered, relettered?
Yes. Oh, here we go. So, see this finding F. The proposed project includes a design which has been amended due to a multitude of differing technical information in the record regarding the coastal bluff. The County acknowledges this differing information, and the proposed project includes a design which takes this into account while allowing for a residence to be constructed on the property. The revised design would include a 25-foot buffer from the edge of the rocks on the property, which is illustrated as the quote-unquote bluff on attachment 4 in the board staff report. That's an added finding before coastal access on the first page of your Exhibit A.
Okay. In second degree, I accept mm-hmm. that as a finding. Is there any changes to conditions or anything else?
Go back up to the conditions. There were, down. I think the only modification was based on comments regarding the design. 1D.
That the requirement is to bring back plans that are consistent with
the nautical style that we saw.
Small scale.
Okay. So I believe that's a relevant and proper condition to have. Does the second agree?
Yes.
All right. So do we have and we'll get to you. Just make sure, Madam Clerk, have you got the Mr. Meacham?
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to say I'm going to stay with option 3. I won't support this because I know the Planning Commission dug through it. They went through it. They had a support for it.
Sure. Understood. All right. And with that, Supervisor Arnold, any
questions? Well, I just wanted to say the same thing. I know this has just gotten really complicated, but for me, too, to make the findings, I just honestly have to say that I don't think I could on the whole bluff situation. So thank you for the.
Very good. So we'll take a roll call vote, Madam Clerk.
For clarification, those were the only two changes different from the original resolution. 1D and then an additional finding, F.
UF.
So just those two. And re-lettered at that point.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
No.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
And Ms. Arnold?
No.
All right. That concludes our business for the day. We thank staff for their work on this, and we will be back next Tuesday.
I don't know if it helps or not, but I have.
I just found it.
Okay.